bouquet of table.
No, I want to hand it over to Val.
Give it over to Valerie. She'll write your name, check things off, whatever.
I need 20 seconds.
You've got plenty of time. Your goal to start. We have, let me do this by date. Here we go. And really, I need to do this for Washington, so I'm going to bring this chart up here for Brewster.
Kill him. Sorry, dude, make sure you put this on your neck.
Oh, yeah.
Make sure we get the best one. Trying to figure out where it would be get the best sound.
You want to put a tone with it?
Yeah, it looks pretty good.
Maybe see the old D-Link?
About the same, yeah.
Okay.
Well, oh, it's great. This is like jewelry, see? Things geek jewelry.
The Connecticut Society Library is now putting them on CD. What? The lectures. If you're a member, you can access the library.
All right. So here's our winter solstice chart for Brewster. I'm going to right-click on that. I'm going to edit that chart data. I'm going to change this over to Washington. D.C. And we can say okay because it is Eastern time. This will work just fine. Oops, I forgot to change the name. Edit that again. This is now for Wash DC. And we hit okay. And we're going to drag this over here and save it. And it's now saved. And let's put this chart now. I'm looking at this chart for Washington, D.C. at the same time you guys are. I have been working with this horoscope. For a while now, working with you guys natally and that sort of stuff. I know pretty much the combinations going on to it, but I haven't applied it to Washington because it's this way it'll be fresh.
No PMP.
We'll get the PMP. One thing at a time.
No, I just was curious.
We will get
the PMP. I'm trying very hard to recall because I just only wondered. Didn't even know that because I'm assuming that.
We'll get those PMPs.
I'm doing solar fire and I can't get my cartwheels to work.
All right. First things first.
Let me just place it somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Except, of course, what's going to happen is we're going to pick up white noise.
I know. I guess on the floor here is about the best spot, like right over here.
Okay. I think it'll record me all right?
Yeah, I'm trying to get
I'm
it away from the noise of
too.
That. So that
I'm recording you, too.
Oh, good. Okay. All right, so looking at this horoscope in general, we're going to be working with this world chart. Now, we've got to go back in a little bit back in time, and we go back to the year 2000. If you guys recall the solstice talk in the year 2000, right after the election, everybody's trying to predict the election and stuff like that. And I was talking with Sam Crawford, Arch Crawford, hot and heavy at that point in time. He's got very good insight. He's the gold guy, the financial guy, and he has great insight into planetary combinations. The guy can just sort of pick them out, you know? And we're both going back and forth, and it was like, well, gee, what's going on? Is all this Kronos Mars stuff happening with these stations, the 28 degrees of Sagittarius, and all this other stuff, and we're going back and forth about it, and we were like, well, it looks like a military coup is occurring in this country, you know? And then at that time, the news came out about the Florida election that they had all these ballots from overseas. And we said, oh, this must be what's going to sway the election. It's going to be these military ballots from overseas and stuff like that. But no, we were right in our first assessment. Essentially, the United States apparently went into a military coup of some sort, or at least a militaristic caucus group took over in this country at that point in time. They got their buddies in the Supreme Court to rule against Florida, etc. No matter how the counts would have come out, it was just so darn corrupt down there that it could have been fought forever. So from the Supreme Court's point of view, they were heading off a larger constitutional crisis. But these things had happened before in the United States. One of the first elections of Jefferson versus Adams was hotly contested and had to be decided by the Senate in the United States. presidents routinely lose the popular vote and become president due to the Electoral College. Why was this one so special? Why did this one have to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court to avert a larger crisis? Somebody else had their hands in the pie. So at that point in time, I got very nervous, and I was on my journeys and stuff like that down south. And doing these series of talks down in New Jersey and New York was killing me, literally, physically. I just could not keep up with it. And I came back in 2001, having analyzed prophecies and things of that nature that I had made and recorded in the 70s, and bouncing it against the current time, and came to the realization that, I don't know if any of you guys remember my old Raving series from the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
When I was doing the Ravings from the Lunatic Mind.
Yeah, brilliant.
And, one of the things I talked about was the fact that we were going to have this great leader at this point in time, and my take on it was that he would be born in China and educated in the East Coast of the United States.
Yeah.
And, well, I was wrong. You know, it's one of the things that's wrong. He lived in China and was educated in the East Coast of the United States. And the other part about that was the fact that this leader was supposed to be a real bad guy. It's like essentially we've had three majorly ruling periods in the history of the world since 1800 that were not very good for mankind. One was Napoleon, and he was always considered traditionally one of the antichrists. Right, and why was he considered an antichrist? Because he had a secular government and went out and wiped out all the Protestants and everybody else in his own movement and didn't care what was going on in the church. The Libertarians of Enlightenment had wiped out the church, pretty much its influence at that point in time. So he was really the first, by definition of the Catholic hierarchy, an antichrist. The next one that comes along is really Hitler and Stalin and Mussolini and all these guys. Really, it was Joe Stalin. Was in the final analysis, Hitler was like going out to a picnic compared to Joe Stalin. The reason Joe was not as vilified as Hitler is today is because the fact that Russia won that war. You know, one of the definitions of the Antichrist is not defeated. You know? Stalin dies in office, leaves no heirs, leaves benign bureaucracy in his wake. Bad guy. And again, where is he heading? He's heading a secular country that has no religious ties to the Catholic Church. The third guy is supposed to come along, and here's the thing, too, is they follow the progression. See, the part that is missed was World War I. And the reason being is because World War I was the symbology where we killed the old world. You know, ever since Alexander the Great, the world has been run by large-scale kings and heroes. If you called somebody a hero at the time of Alexander, they would have ran away and hid because it was not a good term. You know, heroes were guys that went and destroyed governments and wiped out kings and sacked cities. You know, they weren't wearing the cape saving people from stealing trains. You know, they were very nasty characters, brutish. So from that period forward, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years here, ultimately, if you go back further than Alexander, to other large movements like the Sumerians and stuff, the world is ruled by kings and potentates and directed by the various religious groups that underlie them. Now, as we come into the 20th century, well, first we have the Enlightenment in the 18th century, where they say, wait a minute, what's with this religious stuff? What does religion have to do with the governance of the people? The religion has to do with the governing of people's souls, not their secular lives. Right? If religion wants to stay out of feeding the poor, well, then they can stay out governing the poor. Because that's really what the issue in the French Revolution was. The people were starving. And the church, which was based on a communal meal, that's what the early Christian leaders were all about. You know, the early Christian movement was basically a supper club. It was a Greek supper club. Truly, I mean, you know, Paul and Peter would go to some rich, generally rich woman's house, right? And they would have a big banquet and invite poor people over and this and that and talk about the Gospels and have a big meal. They'd reenact the Last Supper. You know, well, the church decided after the 5th century that, well, they can't feed everybody. So, therefore, we'll just do it symbolically. We'll have communal at Sunday will be a symbolic community communal where we'll give them a Eucharist instead. This is my body, this is my blood. And then they cut the wine out. No, it's even worse. So, the basic premise of the Catholic Church was the ministry of the poor, the meek. And, of course, that has nothing to do with the Catholic and Christian churches at this point in time. I mean, you know, to be perfectly honest, you know, you have a bunch of characters who are running these churches who are don't want to kill some life in the womb, but they're certainly willing to do the death penalty. You know, it's like a real oxymoron, because it just wasn't what the original stuff was all about. It was really about food. And this is what caused, and if you've been watching, there's a front line on right now that they're beginning to re-show all the time, but it's pretty fairly common knowledge. What's the reason between the split between the Jewish sects and the Catholic sect? Anybody know?
Thank you, but I saw that last night. It's like the Christians were against sacrificing people or animals or anything, and that got everyone else really upset.
No, wrong. No, the Jewish religion is based on very strict dietary law. It's as much a part of the religion as anything else. You know, and basically they went up to Greek land, and here's the Greeks, they're all eating shellfish, you know, and they're all mixing milk with meat and all that kind of stuff. And they weren't going to change. And not only that, the Jews were the chosen people. You didn't convert to Judaism. They didn't let people in. It was kind of like, hey, can I be part of your family? No, kid, get out of here. You know? And the Jews were persecuted once by the Babylonians, and they got out. But outside of that, they were rich. Judea was the crossroads of all the trade between the East and the West.
They were the fiduciaries.
Yeah, they were the fiduciaries. Well, even before they were the fiduciaries, they controlled the trade. That's why Rome wanted the place. That's why Rome fought several civil wars there, because they had heavy taxation from Rome, and these people were rich. They were living the life of Riley, you know? I mean, come on.
He wasn't a poor carpenter.
No, he was not a poor carpenter. He did not come from a poor family. As a matter of fact, Jesus' brother, James, was the head patriarch of the entire Jewish church by the time, a few years after his assassination. So Jesus' family was pretty well-to-do. And basically, you consider him the Osama bin Laden of his day. Coming from a very rich family and then turning around and saying, you guys are all full of shit. You know? So, but his thing was he was still a Jew, first and foremost. And he did not have a ministry that talked about converting others into Judaism. He was talking a ministry that was very political for reforming Judaism itself. Just like Osama wants to do with the Muslim movement. He's a Wahhabi. They are very strict, and they believe that Islam has fallen into the cracks and is totally corrupt at this point in time and needs to be reformed, and that the Saudi royal family is the target of that reformation. All of this stuff has not been about attacking the United States and the World Trade Towers. It has been attacking foreign infidels sitting in the land of Mecca and Medina. It's really what it's all about. And that the Saudi crown prince and the Saudi ruling family is bad guys. They should not be taking care of these absolute holy religious sites. Real bad thing going on here. The United States is just a bunch of heathens across the sea. They don't even consider us worthy of anything. They're pretty bad guys in general. You know? So you have the situation back then. And you had this whole thing where you had the split between the Jews and the Catholics, and the split occurs because, first of all, Paul is running around converting people. He thinks it's a good idea. Here's this guy who was originally Jewish and joins the Romans, and then decides that he got the light and decided to become a Jew again and then convert everybody else to Judaism. And that got Rome really mad. That's why those guys were all pulled into Rome and immediately put to death. because they were having revolts in Judea. These guys were rabble rousers. They wanted to get rid of the Jews. They wanted to get rid of the Romans so that they could have their money and have their religion back and all this other jazz. Meanwhile, just like the Saudi rulers, you had King Herod, right, with the church lined up with Rome. Just like where if you consider the United States to be Rome and the Saudi rulers to be King Herod, you have a very similar replay of events going on here. And nobody's really quite clear about the origins of these things. So basically, though, the Jews were okay about this for the most part. It's like, all right, you know, we'll take these people in. But this thing with the dietary laws really got their gore. I mean, Peter and Paul said, all right, well, actually, not so much Peter, but Paul said basically, oh, it's okay to eat shellfish. Oh, it's okay to do this. It's okay to do that. To the point where he goes down to Jerusalem and they read him the Riot Act. And basically, he gets real quiet for a couple of years and then decides it was a victory to him. Just like some rulers we know right now. They lose every battle. You know, there's this big deal in the Bible, in the New Testament, about Paul going to the town of Assin and driving out the infidels, driving out the female worshippers of the female deity, essentially. Because Assin was a major religious center of the pagan period and had a continual church for 10,000 years that was based on the female deity. You know, Artemis and Diana, and the secret name was Tiberi, that sort of stuff. And what does he do? It says in the Bible, he went there, brought a big mob with him of some sort. They destroyed the temple, and they destroyed the statue of Artemis, right? Which was basically the woman with all the pomegranates, the breasts, you know, million breasts, and the symbol of fertility, all this other jazz. Well, absolute bald-faced lies. The church, the city fathers saw the mob coming, right? And went and took the statue and buried it in fine sand behind the city hall, behind the city administration building. And then they all left the city. And so this mob comes in, sacks the city, sacks the temple, and leaves. And for 2,000 years, the statue was buried and was discovered about 20 years ago. Brought out perfect shape. Beautiful marble statue. Now, forget which museum. It might be in the Turkish Museum. I'm not sure. In Constantinople. But it's right there. I mean, these guys lied to their people. It was just as much propaganda back then as it is now. So, you have this major split going on, and it all has to do with these dietary things, and it all has to do with this actual, not really a religious movement as much as a political movement that culminates with Masada in 72 AD, which was the last stand, the last Jewish revolt, and the Jews get dispersed. The dysphoria really accelerates at this point in time. Now, the Jews had been in a dysphoria for quite some time before that because they were great traders. They went everywhere to conduct money changes, and you know, it's like Bernie and Phil's furniture store, and they put it open up one in Providence, Rhode Island, and they open up one in Connecticut, and they go out to Connecticut to check it out, and they leave Providence. Well, you know, the distances were similar in the Mediterranean, you know, people would go all over the place. But they got really dispersed after 72 AD. And when we look at the book of Revelations and all this other jazz, who was it they were talking about in the book of Revelations? Who was the sign of the beast and all this other jazz in the book of Revelations? Nero. Nero was sitting there throwing people to the lions and all that other. He had declared war on the Christian sect after the revolt. It was after the revolt. After the Jews were always splattered. And this Catholic church, this Catholicism is spreading around. And it was so novel to the Romans, why they liked it, because these people had real piety. They really believed what they were doing. Whereas the Romans were just sort of paying lip service to the gods. And, you know, they'd go to the temple and have a big party at the temple, and that was basically how they worshiped the gods. And it was what it was all about. These other people, like, they believed in this idea of this afterlife and all this other jazz, you know. I always say to people, you know, when the evangelists knock on the door and stuff like that, I say, well, look, let me give you a riddle. If there's a devil, a a real devil, a guy with horns and hooves running around, and he's entirely charged, this whole thing is charged with getting your soul for eternal damnation. Right? Which was never, by the way, talked about by the Jews, and never talked about by the early Christians. This is something that occurs much later. Right? But there's this guy running around with horns and hooves, right? Pan is running around, he's a devil. Right? And he's charged with doing this. Now, you know this, that if you acquiesce to this person's wishes, you're going to be damned for all time and eternity in the burning flames of hell, or if hell happens to freeze over in the frigid cold down there in Antarctica. What could you possibly offer somebody to give up their eternal soul? I mean, a truly thinking person or a powerful person. What could you possibly offer them? Anybody have any ideas? Remember, the devil can do anything he wants now. He's supposed to be this evil guy. He can lie through his teeth and stuff like that. What could the devil possibly offer you that would make you want to give everything up? That's like the riddle. Sorry, see, you have a hard time thinking about it. I bet you the evangelicals would come in here and say, oh, he's going to offer you this, he's going to offer you that, he's going to offer you the next thing. Eternal youth, Now, honestly, if you're not some stupid redneck watching NASCAR that's been thinking about who they're electing for president, would these things be appealing to you, knowing that for all eternity, once you've given this power up, you're going to have to suffer horrible consequences? There is one thing he would offer you that you would take in a second. Come on.
What it is that you want? Heaven.
That's right. He would offer you heaven. Exactly. Now, what's better than having a desert religion that promises everything after you're dead? come on, is there a better racket than you get everything when you're dead, nothing in this life, it's all when you're dead. But yet there's this whole business that Jesus talked about with this thing called the Holy Trinity, which is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Right? What are they really talking about? It is the soul, the spirit, and the incarnated body. The spirit of life becomes manifest because of the merger of the soul into the inanimate object, into this vessel.
Into this container.
Right? That would tend to say that wouldn't heaven and hell be a function of right here and now? I often say to people that it doesn't matter whether I predict good fortune or bad fortune in terms of money, material goods, or anything else like that. The real measure of good and bad fortune to me is whether you wake up in the morning feeling good about yourself and the world. If you get up in the morning and the world's a happy place, you have good fortune. And it doesn't matter what your conditions are. You could be old and crippled, you could be rich and dissipated, it doesn't matter. But if you feel good, you're doing fine.
You have to wake up.
But if you wake up in the morning, and you feel like shit, and the world stinks, and everybody should go and jump in a hole, well, that's hell. That's bad fortune. And it's right here on this planet. You don't get anything more. And then think about past lives and all that other good stuff, right? Another big facet of Catholic teachings is this idea of reincarnation, that you got to keep the body in good shape even when it's dead and moldy, because they're going to be reanimating the body at some point. Yeah. You're going to come back and walk around on Earth again for a while, right? This whole business about reincarnation and stuff, well, all well and good, but what effect does having knowledge of your past life affect this life? Not much. To be perfectly honest, a real-world example is I'm the reincarnation of a guy named Carl Ernst Kraft. Not many people get to know who their most immediate reincarnation was, but it's pretty clear that I was this guy before. He was an idiot, and he was an astrologer in the 30s. He wrote a very good book called The Biological Traits of Astrology. He was French. He was a Swiss. And he really liked the Nazis. and kept going up and practicing astrology in Berlin until finally they said, look, we can't protect you anymore. They threw him in a concentration camp, at which point he died of dysentery in 1945 on his way to Buchenwald. But he was a white Aryan, so he wasn't going to gas chambers. They had him doing work. They had him doing translations of Nostradamus to drop on the British troops. So they would, you know, and he just really was mad about that. He couldn't handle lying about what Nostradamus' interpretations were. But the point being, though, what good did it do me to know this? This is my life. I'm not Carl Ernst Kraft. He had his own life to live, you know? I have nothing to do with it. And it was very interesting was that I learned about Kraft and his connection from several people, and after I had gotten my degree in astrology. And apparently Carl had tried to get his degree from Sorbonne in astrology in 1936, and failed because his father forced him to go into his family business. Well, I had already broken his trajectory by then. In other words, and you look at the chart, too, and you could see there was, you know, all these connections. For example, the distance from his sun natally to his midheaven was the solar arc opening of his death day to my birthday. So it was 1945 to 1951, it was a 6-degree opening from his natal sun to the midheaven. So if it moved to the midheaven, and I could pop out. We had all these other combinations that, like, just sort of changed a little bit. It's enough that I'm in a different situation. I don't have to deal with his karma, so to speak. So it really doesn't do me a lot of good.
Other than that you already were aimed at astrology.
Yeah, well, I was working in astrology in a different way, but it doesn't really do me any good because it's some other life. It's another experience. I don't remember that experience. I may have a dream or two where things blend through and I get a vision of stuff, but that's exactly what it is. It's like, you know, dreams are the crack between the worlds, you know, you're moving in, out of space and time, you know, internally. So,
well, if you died in the last life by dropping a blow dryer in the bathtub, you may not do that again in this life.
That's true. That's quite possible, you know. But then again, you know, fate is another thing altogether, you know. As I mentioned, to me, heaven and hell is right here on this planet, right here in this life. And if this life is your life, this is it. This is all you get. All you get. And the whole point of it is to pick up experiences, whether those experiences are good or bad. It doesn't matter, you know, because on the larger scale of it, your sense of experience, what it is that you're actually experiencing as you're moving through life, isn't necessarily feeding your soul, but feeding a larger collective soul, you know? And so you have to understand, even at our level, we're in a serving position, you know? We have to serve other entities. Some of these entities are visible, some of these entities aren't. You know, and we're not very free. Astrology gives us certain boundaries that say, oh, well, we've got free will and stuff. Honestly, free will is inside your head. And it all has to do with how you interpret the experiences that are happening. And if you interpret them poorly, right, well, life stinks. If you interpret them well, life is wonderful. But it's the only place that it really occurs. Everything else on the external plane is sort of faded. Hans used to come from a different, my old teacher, Hans Niggemann, he came from a slightly different perspective. He said, oh, fate is like spotlights. So you've got to dance in the shadows. Don't get caught in the light. If you dance in the shadows, you can get away with stuff. And he says, you can get away with a lot of combinations until they gang up on you. And then you get mugged. If there's too many combinations to get mugged, you can't escape, and that's called fate. Because that's him, that was fate. You know? And it's coming from a guy who spent 6 months shooting people every day for 8 hours a day in World War One and kicking them into a trench. So, that's all he did. For 6 months, he's hung out in front of a had the guys dig their own trench, line up, shot them, pushed them in. Next group came, shot them, pushed them in. Shot them, pushed them in. Got the Iron Cross for that. And that was World War One. So we have these things with these antichrists and whatnot coming along. We know that whatever Jesus was talking about had absolutely nothing to do with what we call Catholicism today. Absolutely nothing. Not one shred of connection, period. Nothing. Zero. There's no connection whatsoever. You know, we have a Jewish political rabble rouser and some other guys, after his death, made this thing and it's a business. A lot of land holdings going on there. And so we have this whole thing. So this whole definition, this redefinition of the revelations, which really had to do, as I said, with Nero bumping everybody off right in their day and age. And you got to remember, too, by 60 A.D., the early Catholics were getting very discouraged with the church because the second coming didn't happen. You see, Jesus was supposed to die on the cross, and everybody said, oh, that's it, he's dead. This whole business of the second coming and all this other jazz wasn't part of the script, wasn't part of the scenario. But he comes back, right? Within 3 days, he comes back. And he says, oh, yeah, I'm going to come back another time, you know? And then when I come back, everything's going to be cool. And he goes away again. And so it's like, gets everybody really upset and flipped out. And so this whole idea of the second coming, well, they expected him back in their lifetime. And it didn't happen. And they all started, the early church fathers started dying. And this almost killed the religion right then and there. It was almost self-destructive because it was built on all these things. But things change. You know, guys change the instruction, change the orientation. So by the time that 72 comes around and we have that great fall at Masada, we have the great last great Jewish rebellion, the Essenes are all dead and all these other guys are all dead, and the Jews are dispersed to a large extent. Everybody converts to Catholicism to some extent because it actually promised something after this earthly existence. You got to remember, most of the people had absolutely piss poor, miserable existences unless you were a rich citizen of Italy. You know, if you were a rich citizen of the empire, you did good. But other than that, it was terrible existence, and death was hoped for. It was so bad. Death was, take me away, please. You know. That we get to 325 A.D., we get to 350 A.D. and 525 A.D., where the early church fathers, the early Catholic Christian church really had no center. They had all these competing thoughts. The biggest split was between Paul and Peter. Mm-hmm. And Peter was purely Jewish, and Paul was like this reveler. As a matter of fact, you might blame the Roman crackdown on the Christians on Paul more than anything else.
What we have now is Paul.
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Paul's orientation. He was a real idiot. But you know, real idiot. So
it's interesting what you said about the second coming, because Olympus, the 13th Pope, actually set a fiat telling them to get a life. And that set the parameter of the church being able to own land.
Right. They have to deal with the secular world.
Right. It's called the Montana fiat.
Yeah, if it didn't come, well, we gotta deal with this world as it stands. You know?
And that was in like 179, somewhere around there.
So what occurs here, though, is by 325 and all its other days, these splits in the church get really out of hand. And you have a big split between the followers of Saint Nestor, who is the family of Jesus. This is the family of Jesus, or the Nestorites, as they're called. And they were in Jerusalem, and they were in the Fertile Crescent. These are the guys that were still left back in Babylon after the Jews left. I mean, there were still groups back there. These were the priests. They controlled the water regulation. They controlled the flooding of the Tigris and the Euphrates River. That area of the planet was called the Fertile Crescent. Saudi Arabia was not a desert. Saudi Arabia was the breadbasket of the world. Right? They were the Nestorites, and they were much more like the Gnostics in their orientation. They had competing ideas. It was a pell-mell. It was more of a movement than a doctrine. And then up in the north, the remnants of the disintegrating Roman Empire, they sort of transferred the crown to become a pope. And you're up there in Constantinople, and the followers of St. Cyril have a big synod, and they call all the bishops in, and they basically said, all right, everybody who's with us, raise your hand. Okay, you can leave the room. And everybody else was put to death. Their eyes were put in a jar so that St. Cyril could see with their sight. And then goes on the First Holy Crusade. And the First Holy Crusade went through the Middle East and wiped out the Nestorites, which sent the Fertile Crescent into a 700-year decline. 700 years from 5th century to 12th century, so the Fertile Crescent turned to a desert. Flat out desert. Because the water no longer were the water. You know, these were the astrologers too. I mean, we were decimated in this as well. Because we were the guys that were left over from the Babylon that said when the river. We made good calendars. The Catholics and the Christians never were able to make a good calendar. They had to differentiate themselves from the Jewish lunar calendar, so they went with the Roman calendar, but that didn't work too well either. So it took a long time for them to get the calendar stuff together because they wiped out all the people that could make calendars, and which was us. So the Fertile Crescent falls into ruin, and the Nestorites get wiped out, and they went right down to Alexandria and wiped out the library in Alexandria. The books being burned there were not burned by Muslim fanatics. As a matter of fact, the early followers of Islam, of Muhammad, revered the works, revered the Greek works, and tried to rebuild the library several times. But it was the early Catholics that destroyed the libraries. And one of the interesting things, I had a history of astrology teacher, a guy named Dr. Michael Hudson, in like 1971 or 72, which is basically what they did was they would go before each exhibit, right? Like they'd be like a steam engine that opened up castle doors or batteries and that. And they'd say, okay, if your pagan gods are stronger than our god, your pagan gods will stop us from destroying this exhibit. And they would destroy the exhibit and they'd turn around to people and say, see, what good are your gods? We can destroy all of their work. And they did. And the library kept them warm for 10 years. The paper, burning the paper. It took them 10 years to burn the library books. You know? So they were going through the books. Up, into the flames. This is heresy. Heresy. That's why we have that, what is it, the Nag Hammurabi? I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correct. The works that were found. Not the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls are one thing. That's just really the records of a specific Athenian group, which does constitute what the Bible was at that time. The Bible doesn't get codified for a bunch of centuries later. The Jews themselves were still in a process of growing and developing their own religion. But the Nag Hammurabi material was discovered in 1947 outside of Cairo in a cache, and basically was material smuggled from the burnings in Alexandria. And considered all the heretical stuff, you know. If you read this book, you have to be put to death. Essentially, that kind of stuff. You know, if you know what's in this book, you can possess it, but if you can read it, you're put to death. And it gets really bad that by the 7th or 8th century in Europe, if you could read the Bible, you were a pagan and put to death. Because of a pagan knowledge to be able to read. That's why the scribes were in the church, or the monks, would be constantly re-illuminating the Bible and making it out of pictures. If you go to Notre Dame in Paris, right, there's this very classic cathedral where if you look at the doors and over the top in the stonework, there's the whole story of Genesis. It's presented pictorially. And the whole idea is because nobody was supposed to be able to read. This is how they can do it. They look at the pictures. And people were more attuned to symbolism in the pictures than they were, today. Today we don't catch the stuff that the guys in the field would catch when they would look at a picture. You know, the picture was, when they talk about a picture being 1,000 words, well, we have too many pictures and not enough words. This in the modern era, but it was just the opposite in the older eras. So we get to this whole thing, and you have this church there, and they're sort of complacent. Every once in a while, a bunch of fanatics believe there's going to be the end of the world. And the last time was at the first millennium. That was a real big deal. A lot of people lost money in real estate because they were selling their holdings in anticipation of moving on and off the planet. So we get to current time. We get to the Enlightenment period. And the first of these great antichrists start coming up, right? You know, the church forgets about these revelations for a few hundred years at a time, but they're real hot right now. And the first one, of course, as I mentioned, was Napoleon. But then we have this one of World War I, which I've talked about many times, where essentially as a unit, as a collective, we did an Oedipal complex. We killed all our fathers, which were the kings, the potentates, you know, the hereditary rulers. You know, even to this day, if you recall when Belgrade had their big revolt and was run by this guy Ceausescu and his wife, and they took them out immediately and just shot them in the courtyard, right? And what was the wife saying? But you're my children, you know, you can't turn against the... Well, it was exactly that. I mean, these potentates considered everybody little children, and that they were the parents, you know, and how could they possibly turn against? Same thing with the Last Czar. You know, you read those letters, and they treat, you know, very pious people, you know, they lived a very deliberately simple life with the rest of the court that was gilded, so to speak, that was spending all the money. These pious people, and again, they're complaining that how could the people turn against us when all we've done is sacrifice for them? Oh, my stupid kids, you kids today, how could you be so ungrateful, you know, after all the sacrifices we did for you? We sent you for ballet lessons and all this stuff, right? We gave you bread. Wasn't that enough, you know, one time? So you have this big thing, and that's World War I, and World War I allows, the European Revolution allows guys like Hitler and Mussolini and all to come forward. And the current regime is more like Mussolini than anything else. And Mussolini chose the term fascism, right? And Hitler never considered himself a fascist. He was a national socialist. And this is real important. He's not like Mussolini. I mean, they were not the same guys. Right. Franco was a national socialist, right? Mussolini was a fascist, and the whole thing of the fascist was the bundle of sticks, that individually you could break each stick, but if you bundle them together, they're strong. And what did the sticks consist of? Was the government, the military, and the industrial complex. Now, what is going on in the U.S. today? The government, the military, and the industrial complex. Bound by a strong ruler who knows what the people need. And we'll tell you what you need. Right? We don't need any dissenting voices. It means nothing gets done. You have debate and dissent, nothing gets done. We need action. And only a strong person can do action. We can't have no whipple waffles happening here. That's Mussolini's point of view. Hitler, on the other hand, was more like, you know, you know, he did the same thing, though. You know, basically, what was his motivation for walking into Austria and Czechoslovakia and all that again? What was the first thing he did?
We know that?
No, they wiped out the national treasury and melted the gold down. Period. The first thing they did, they wiped out the national, melted the gold down, and then traded it with the Swiss. The Swiss were bought off, okay, during the war. The Swiss were not neutral. The Swiss were bought off.
That's wrong.
But he did give everybody vacations. He
gave everybody vacations.
Before
gave
that, bonds. People didn't have vacations. That was Hitler's idea.
That was Hitler's idea. Any time off.
Not that makes up for anything. But I guess that's the socialist part. He gave everybody vacations in VW bus.
That was
It was Bismarck that invented the idea of retirement. And they said it at age 66, figuring nobody would live that long. No, really?
Yes.
Because the average lifespan was 47 years at the turn of the century. So if you made it to 65, the state would give you a pension. You did your good job for the state. These are all German inventions. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with the United States. The United States was, you know, William Jennings Bryan lost every election, you know? He was the populist guy. And then he goes and does the Scopes-Monkey trial. You know? can, you know, can't win normally, you turn to religion. So we come to now, right? We come to this third Antichrist period. And I couldn't believe it in 2001 that this jerk from Texas turns out to be the next leader in the world, and it lets me know that these other guys must have really been stupid. You know, he's run by Karl Rove, literally, and he's run by his handlers. You know, Bush really doesn't have a lot going for him. He never did. He is a dry drunk. He's easily manipulated.
Did you call him Wilson Pinson?
No.
Oh, I was trying to remember his name. Do you remember his name, the minister of the Dryden?
Oh, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. He didn't dry him. He just, you know, just turned one.
I think it was Billy Graham, wasn't it?
No.
You mean the Bob Jones thing?
Was it Bob? No.
That's the university, Bob Jones.
Yeah. But either way, it was a small ministry in Texas, and just happened to go to the thing and decided to found religion, you know, which is always the last refuge of somebody who's got real problems. So you have this guy, and I mean, he obviously is brain damaged, and he obviously is still an addictive personality. I'm calling this guy almost choked on a pretzel, you know? I mean, you know, it's like he's pretty stupid. He really is. The more you dig into it, you realize that the only reason this guy is around is because of his family connections and the fact that he has good handlers. And he didn't even choose his handlers, you know? So it's a sad thing. And that always does make for a bad leader, you know, someone who's weak and that's it. Like Nero. There's a strong parallel here. You know, Nero was really full of himself and was a weak leader, didn't know how to stand up to stuff at the right time and made edicts and
he was a Sagittarius, and I read somewhere that all he really wanted to be was an actor.
Yes.
But he ended up, he had the emperor, so.
Yeah, he had the emperor. I mean, what a drag.
And then he would sneak out at night and put on plays and kill people who didn't like them.
It's all true. He was the first guy. He was the real emperor. He was the one that capitulated. So, we have this guy come into power. And in 2001, I decide that, well, it isn't worth it for my health. And it isn't worth it for me to be putting myself out on the planet like this. Given the dark climate we're moving into. Now, I've often said that the dark time started in 1992 with the Uranus and Neptune conjunction. And we're in the first world. I mean, we are the dark country. You know, we are the bad guys in that sense. And so, obviously, our standard of living is up higher at the expense of everything else, at the expense of the rest of the world. You know, we accelerated our secular thing since World War II, but now we're punching religion into it. It gets very strange. I once passed an email around the shop that was from a reporter who was over in Davos, Switzerland, during one of the economic summits, shortly after Ashcroft was appointed as Attorney General. And she's writing like, it was a very different, you know, it's like she wrote her piece for Newsday and this and that, and then she was like sending a chatty letter off to her friends. Oh, guess what I'm doing? I'm off in Switzerland hobnobbing with the rich and famous of the world, you know, about the real movers and shakers and this and that. And here's what they really think about us. And she goes on to talk about the fact that she went to a breakfast meeting, and before they started the meeting, they had to have a prayer vigil led by Ralph Reed. Right, and it got the Europeans real nervous, because to them it was the same thing as having a Hindu have to have a religious sacrifice before their meeting, or a Muslim praying to Allah and stuff. And they're very secular. I mean, they've had two centuries of wars over these very issues that it got them very nervous. Like, we're no longer in Kansas anymore. Kind of thing. So right even then, early on, you had all of this stuff going on. I mean, what is the difference between a religiously obsessed terrorist and a religiously obsessed country? There is none. You know, both have the same aims. They're both attempting to impose their will on others. Period. And this world has come too far for that. the end of World War II, the end of the European Revolution. By 1949, the world is supposed to be running on its own. It's supposed to be running where everybody is an informed electorate. You know, to continue to manipulate. It's like, kind of like, you know, you're 20 years old and you're still living at your parents' house, and you're really supposed to be out having a job and putting yourself through your finishing school and whatnot, but you'd rather let mom do the laundry. You know, I mean, this is the easy approach. The same thing with our leaders. You know, we're supposed to take responsibility for what our leaders do, but I'm too concerned about the Super Bowl, so we'll let somebody else do it, you know. Unbelievable. You know, I won't even get into the fact that the guy that brings us, we would rather have a president who makes us impoverished than a president who makes us rich but gets a blowjob in the White House. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And this president won this election by scaring the hell out of people in the Heartland, as you know, by threatening that there's going to have to be gays kissing in your front lawn, you know? So you better not get these guys going in. But as I said, in the long run, it might be one of the better things, at least for the Democratic Party, that has occurred. So I got real scared, and so for the last 2 years, we've been just doing these social... Here we are at the Meridian for Washington, right? And you see that on this meridian, right? The sun is rising at Washington. Saturn's setting in the seventh house. Node is on the bottom of the chart. Right? Moon is at the bottom of the chart. And we have the Saturn here dead on square the meridian.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mentioned to some other folks earlier that since September 29th, the midpoint of Saturn and Uranus has been the cardinal axis. So we can look over here, we'll see it. It's still somewhat in effect. If I drag this over to here, there's the midpoint of Saturn and Uranus in the sky. Very close to the cardinal axis. You see it? So, this midpoint... And basically what's been going on there is that as Saturn went forward, Uranus was moving retrograde, they both stationed, and then Uranus began to move forward, and Saturn began to retrograde. And Saturn's moving a little bit faster than Uranus now. But that midpoint stayed within 6 or 7 minutes of the cardinal axis until December 13th. Then it finally begins to part. So between September 29th and December 13th, Saturn and Uranus stands on the cardinals, it means stress city.
Yeah.
It means that everything is reduced to a black and white choice.
It's a pressure cooker
aspect. It's a knee-jerk reaction. In other words, everything is like, whoa, whoa, I'm stressed, heart attack. Right.
That's when the Electoral College election happened, the 13th, or the 12th, something like that.
Yeah. Well, it's beginning to pop apart by that point. But even here on December 21st, you see that even though it's popping apart, it's still within a quarter of a degree, half a degree here of arc. Let's see exactly what it is. 2937. So it's like 23 minutes away. You know, even by then.
Oh,
all right. Now, it's going to move backwards a little bit, then it'll come forward again. All right, that's number one, is that that's what this entire election occurred, this election cycle occurred within, was this whole thing. Number two is that if we take by the thought that the United States government went away in December of 2000, at least formally, well, then what's the difference between the Democratic and the Republican parties at this point in time?
What kind of I mean, you've got staunch Republicans taking the side of Democrats and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Is there any real difference between the parties?
Not really.
No. Yes. What is it?
Demo Republicans.
So there really isn't very much difference between these two parties at this point in time. The difference happens to be the perception of faith, right? Where you have Karl Rove monopolizing and utilizing all these religious guys.
Perception being the operative word in the sentence.
Right. It's a perceptive thing more than anything else. Because look, both guys want to pursue the war in Iraq. Even though it's ludicrous for us to be there. You know what I mean? And it even gets worse. I mean, you know, hey, look, we invade this country because there's this tyrant over there. Okay, he has mass destruction. All right, or he didn't have weapons. All right, he's a bad guy. We should just be over there, right? All right, well, we got rid of him. Well, what the hell are we doing in Fallujah? I mean, this is the Iraqis revolting themselves, saying, we don't want you in our city, right? So it's like, oh, no, it's these foreign interventionary from Jordan. Oh, new guys that made buddies with Osama, you know? The bottom line is, it's like, come on, we got rid of Saddam. We should just leave. Let them have their civil war. You know, if Saddam was so bad, you know, why are we directing their civil war? Why are we making ground rules for them?
Now,
well, there's an interesting thing here. There's an article that you can get here by a guy named Dan Gruff called Debating a Neocon. And this guy's talking about how he had to come back. He's a, you know, a liberal guy, right? And he has to come back and he has to do this debate at some college with a neocon guy, right? He speaks at the Winthrop University in South Carolina. He gave this talk on like November 9th or something like that, right? And he comes back, and he had been down in Haiti, where he said, while I was in Haiti, a full-blown intifada had broken out against the de facto U.S. puppet government of Gerard La Tortue, and I had to extend my trip for a week, right? And he goes, so I'm sick, because I got an amoeba, and I had to get ready for this talk. And all of a sudden, he starts looking at the credentials. He could as well be a simple talk. He starts looking at the credentials of the guy that he's supposed to debate, and it's this guy Patrick Clawson, who's the deputy director of Washington Institute for Near East Policy, author of more than 30 scholarly articles on the Middle East, right, has testified before congressional committees more than a dozen times, co-governor of the Presidential Study Group organized by Washington Institute, which makes recommendations to the Bush administration, blah, 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 blah. From 1997, he was a senior researcher at the Institute of National Strategic Studies for the National Defense, blah, 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 edited all these works, how to build a new Iraq after Saddam, the last Arab-Israeli battlefield, implications of an Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon, dollars and diplomacy, the impact of U.S. economic initiatives in the Arab-Israeli negotiations, Iran under Khatami, a political, economic, and military assessment, on and on and on. He just keeps writing all these books, right? He graduated with a doctoral degree from the New School for Surgical Research, bachelor's from Oberlin College, speaks Farsi, French, Spanish, German, and Hebrew. The guy goes, well, my silent reaction to viewing this information was, holy shit, I've got maybe 4 hours prepared to debate in front of God knows how many people with this six-language-speaking, ultra-curriculum-vetted foreign policy PhD Near East scholar who had a coin to the ad for the debate just driven 22,000 miles around Iraq. The guy's got Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz on his advisory board, who turns out to personally know the vice president. How am I going to win this debate? Right. So he works up all night, and he goes and turns out this whole thing. Right. He has to put together a talk about it. Right? So he thinks, oh, he might red bait me. He might just claim my politics up front and take my argument away from him. I can't get tangled up in minutiae. I'll denounce Perry early and often so he can't turn it into a post-election debate about Bush's mandate. I can't claim that the war is about stealing oil, a favorite bit of nonsense among liberals that can be easily demolished. You know, I can't talk about the crisis, as a crisis of capitalism because they never want to discuss this. Hit him in his Zionism because it's basically indefensible any time a couple of actual facts are deployed, and if it gives me any shit, bring up the USS Liberty. A low blow, I know, but I have to go there. I didn't have to go there, as it turned out. You know, the US Liberty was monitoring things during the Israeli war, and the first thing the Israelis did was bomb it. with our own ship. We just took it right out. Boom. Right? So, election campaigns, debates that are now thankfully passed, we heard about the usual point-counterpoint about weapons of mass destruction, who can more competently carry out military occupations, who is convinced what allies can help carry this burden, what's been done about Islam, or who is more competent to carry about the war of terrorism. But I can't deal with that. I think these arguments are red herrings, right? This is the real argument. I don't believe the war is the exclusive product of delusional thinking of the Islamophobic clique that surrounds our current presidential mediocrity, as many liberals suggest. I don't believe the war ever had anything to do with weapons of mass destruction. I don't believe the very people who call this a war on terrorism believe it for 1 minute. And moreover, I believe they know perfectly well that the term war on terrorism is an oxymoronic in so much as one cannot prosecute a war against a tactic. I don't believe it is a war to steal anybody's oil, though it has everything to do with oil and more. The fact is that half the people in the United States believe at some point that a shattered nation like Iraq constituted a threat to the United States does not compel me for a moment to refrain from pointing out that this is a proposition that was and is idiotic on the face of it, and it's not at all unusual for half of a national population to believe something that is patently idiotic. I am not a conservative, and I am not a liberal, I am not a politician, I am not a pacifist, I am not religious, so I am not the least compelled or constrained to prop up the Ptolemaic foundations of any of these agendas. I believe that the war in Iraq is symptomatic of a much deeper global crisis, and that it foreshadows a period in which that crisis, a crisis of global capitalism, will manifest itself not only in war, but in a rapidly widening social destabilization, further militarization of the world system, and simultaneous economic and environmental collapse. Just in case there is a temptation to resort to red baiting to just avoid responding to the content of my arguments, let me save you the trouble. I am on record as a severe critic of capitalism as an inherently destructive system built on genocide and slavery, sustained by misogyny, racism, poverty, and war, and bound to undermine its own material basis through ecocide. I do not, however, believe, as some leftists seem to do, that a more sensible system will inevitably replace it. If progressives continue to whine and wring their hands instead of fighting back, we could very well end up with a century or so of anarchy and warlords in the context of a mass-human die-off on a ruined and toxified planet. Present-day imperialism is a real system, and it is currently directed by the American state. The war in Iraq was probably an inevitable action of this state in response to an impending and inexorable erosion of the very basis of American global power. The war in Iraq, while deeply and morally repugnant, is not a failure of morality, but the action of a system that can't help it. Republicans and Democrats can't tell you this. Pacifists and the true religious believers won't tell you this. Politicians, who will tell you only what you want to hear, won't tell you this. But I believe it is irresponsible to delay telling the patient who is about to die of gangrene the unpleasant fact that the leg must be amputated. Global capitalism runs on fossil energy, but the United States does not have to take oil from anyone. Every oil-producing nation, including Iraq, has been perfectly willing to sell oil to the U.S. It is cheaper to buy oil than it is to steal it with military action. The issue of oil is an issue not of production, but of increasing demand between competitors in a period when we have nearly reached the peak of global output. The demand is now at 79.5 million barrels of oil a day. The International Energy Agency and the Department of Energy predict global demand of 115 million barrels per day by 2020. But that is based on rising at a 1.25% per year. In fact, demand is rising at twice that rate. The industry experts, who are not spinning figures to reassure stockholders, tell us with massive improvements in infrastructure and perfect political stability, the highest output achievable is around 85 million barrels per day. This year, China passed Japan as the world's second largest importer of crude oil. If anyone believes Cheney's Energy Task Force, on which Dr. Clawson served, did not review these figures as part of their long-term strategic assessment, and how it relates to continued possibilities, I have a mountaintop retreat to sell you in Miami. So the question of oil is not a question of taking it. It's a question of the mathematics of it. And when global capitalistic competition continues to trend towards 100 million barrels a day by the end of the decade, when there's not adequate flow pressure to meet that demand, someone gets cut. And someone decides who gets cut.
Establishing permanent military bases in the very region where over half the remaining easily accessible reserves exist goes a long way towards putting the power that controls those bases in the driver's seat. As a friend of mine once said, oil is not a normal commodity. No other commodity has five U.S. Navy battle groups patrolling the sea lanes to secure it. Iraq's pre-invasion production was around 2.5 million barrels per day, but even with heroic effort to restore it, production has not risen above 1.8 million barrels a day, and has actually been a net loss of 700,000 barrels a day. The U.S. military effort alone is calculated to have an energetic cost of 350,000 barrels of oil a day. Just keep our troops there. This is not business math. This is geopolitical and military math. What is being sought is a new foundation, a military one, upon which to base U.S. supremacy as the current one is beginning to crumble. And the reliance on a direct military violence to achieve one's national aims is not a sign of strength, but a sign of weakness, a sign that there is a fundamental failure of hegemony. Hegemony is not direct control, but internalization of control by those who are dominated. Now, in 68, Richard Nixon inherited the hair-raising collapse of the U.S. Treasury's gold pool and the unwinnable occupation of Vietnam that caused it. Within the next 4 years, Nixon would abandon fixed currency exchange rates and the gold standard, then allow a 20% devaluation of the dollar that wiped out billions of dollars in U.S. debts to Western Europe and Japan. Since oil payments were predominated in dollars, and the consequent jump in the price of oil was a harsh blow for Europe, Japan, Africa, and Latin America, the U.S., on the other hand, owned the dollar printing press and was able to recycle the crisis via petrodollars to these regions. The U.S. puppet governments in Iran and Saudi Arabia helped underwrite the system with their ability to swing oil production. This game of economic chicken by Nixon set the stage for the new method to assure U.S. supremacy, since the post-World War II industrial boom had run aground on the rocks of the Marshall II Plan of export capacity and on Vietnam. So, the currency speculation that this abandonment of the gold standard and fixed exchange rate stimulated led invariably to a currency crisis in weaker nations, whereupon Reagan administration, in response to Mexican currency crisis in 82, gave the U.S. its first crack at loan sharking through the International Monetary Fund, in which it held controlling polarity and exclusive veto power. This loan sharking is called, quote, structural adjustment, unquote, and not only believes 70 different nations white with an unpayable external debt, paid in dollars, by the way, these loans are contingent on allowing U.S. investors to penetrate national economies to take over key economic sectors. The system is now referred to as neoliberalism, but I call it debt leverage imperialism. It is arguable that a Treasury bill standard by which U.S. is able to force its capitalist competitors, who have lion's share of the central bank reserves, right, they know that they can never pay the money back to the U.S., and they have to accept the dollar is overprinted, overvalued at its current level for fear it will wipe out the value of their own central bank. Look at Argentina. Mm-hmm. Argentina indexed their currency to the U.S. dollars and overnight went bankrupt. A country that was as rich as we are in terms of the per capita crisis is now as poor as the poorest Latin American country. Right? The continuing growing glut of fiat dollars created by the conditions of the precarious Asian meltdown of 88, the dot-com bust of 2000, and for the real estate bubble that will burst next. U.S.'s public debts are at record levels, and if I should say there is a deflationary crisis around a falling dollar, the U.S. middle class will sink to the bottom like the Titanic.
It's happening.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Now.
You forgot to mention wheat. Something else I saw the other day is that says
there's not enough wheat. China
used to make enough wheat, but now they've started importing it.
That's
and so
correct.
We're going to be competing with them, and the price of that's going to start.
No, we're a net exporter of wheat.
We're net exporters of wheat.
That means more money for us.
Yeah.
That means more money for us. We like that idea. That's why Monsanto keeps control over the patents for all the food it's engineering. So now they can control farmers everywhere else because they control, the seeds are self-destructing. They give these guys corn seeds, right, with the BT bacterium embedded in it, right, which is really a Franken food. You have to understand that
Europeans hate it, so that's...
You have to understand that First of all, we've been genetically manipulating animals and food in year one. Now, we can do it with more technology and faster. The fact that we're crossing pure species, like putting a germ inside a plant, means we're putting an animal in a vegetable, like, is real Frankenstein stuff. You know, it really is. But if we make a gene, say, that, modify a gene, say, that makes a potato bigger, you know, with the golden russet potato was the first one to get the BT bacterium, and that was made from McDonald's, like, to make a potato bigger, that's fine. I mean, more people get sick. If we make straw, like the Sleeper, remember Woody Allen's Sleeper, right, where he had the bananas as big as a house and stuff like that, and he's like going crazy, right? Well, I mean, if we can make strawberries as big as a house, and we can do this. Well, this benefits the rest of the world in general. But when we own the seed and we make the seed self-destructing, in other words, the plant can't sow seeds because the seeds carry a virus or something that destroys the seed itself. So they can't even carry it further. And not only that, they're getting international control that if a farmer in Mexico is found to have genetically engineered soy in their other crop because the wind blew the pollen over, they can seize the guy's crop and charge him a lot of money because it's violating intellectual property. This is a bad thing. So you see the hegemony of the United States going all over the world. You know, it's like that's not just oil, right, where we have all these battle cruisers and stuff. Way out here with the wind farm, right? The wind farm debate that's going on and stuff like that. Right? I keep having a battle with Pat. She wants to drag me out to one of the debates. She doesn't get it that I don't really want to go public. But you want to drag me out to one of the wind farm debates. What is the real thing going on with the wind farm? It has nothing to do, I mean, you know, you have the one side finally saying, oh, you get this pristine area of water, we shouldn't put ugly things in it and industrialize it. And you have this other crew saying, oh my God, if we don't put this wind farm up, we're going to be breathing bad air because it's coal-fired plants. Do you think that the wind farm is going to displace one oil or coal-fired plant anywhere in the United States? What is it going to displace? It's going to displace some energy production. Why? Hydroelectric and other renewable sources, because you can't shut a fossil plant down overnight and start it up again. The grid is not a battery. In other words, all the electricity coming in here, shining that thing on the wall, has to be generated with the load and demand in mind. The grid's not a battery. It doesn't store energy. Right? So you have all these, and that's why we have blackouts. You know, some tree will fall on a wire somewhere and short out a transformer. And if the guy in the other end doesn't balance, the computers don't balance the load fast enough, everybody starts pouring their juice into that short and the whole system comes down. It is not a battery. It doesn't store energy. It can only allocate energy. Right? And if you have a coal-fired plant, how does a coal-fired plant operate? It operates on steam, on turbines. And it takes a long time. It takes a whole week to get a turbine plant up, cranked up to power, running at the right RPM, to bring it online. Take it offline, the same process occurs. You just don't shut these plants down. You have to crank them back, shut the turbines down, shut the boilers down, and the process takes several days. So we have a hurricane scheduled to come up the coast, and all this and that, and wind farms are going to be generating twice the output. Well, they are going to turn off Brant Point. Right, they're not going to turn off the Marant plant over here in Sandwich because they couldn't even get it shut down fast enough. But they can shut the floodgates on the hydroelectric up in Quebec, at the St. Lawrence Seaway, or the James Bay hydroelectric power plant. Here, you just drop a sluice in, and you shut down the turbine generators, which are turning not from steam, but from the actual water flow itself. So what is it going to display? It's going to display other renewable sources. No matter what anybody tells you. Right? That's number one.
That's not what I agree.
There's even more.
It's all run on an auction system, and the oil is the most expensive electricity, so they will lose the auction, and they will have to shut it down whether they want to or not.
Well, then there comes
not only that, but each plant has like about 6 generators, and they can just shut down one of them.
Right, because
it's a parking lot.
It's a parking lot.
Okay.
We'll get
Now, the other part of it, you know, auctions notwithstanding, Ray, they can't rely upon what's called an opportunistic energy source. Where, what if the wind, what if they don't bid for that oil and the wind stops? We have a becalmed day. One becalmed day, the whole thing goes awry. You know? It's not like California in the bids. Our contracts are long term. You know, that's why I've come to Compact to be able to generate a 10-year contract. It's different than California where they were bidding on a day-to-day auction. Yes, there are day-to-day auctions going on, but they're in between grids. There's negotiations between other grids, you know? The next thing on this is, if you have that problem, right, with displacement of power, you have a secondary problem with it. And that is, it actually is supporting fossil fuel infrastructure. What's the fuel of the future? Where are we going in the future for fuel? Hydrogen.
That's where they're supposed to be going.
That's where we're supposed to go.
And not only that, like with the now.
And with but because they have a lot of money invested in their infrastructure. And that hydrogen is supposed to be little power plants.
Yeah.
Right? It's supposed to be centralized, supposed to be off the grid. You build a little subdivision, you put in your little power plant, your little fuel cell set up, it's run by hydrogen, the output is water and oxygen, and everybody's happy, and you're off the grid. Now, how do you make hydrogen? It isn't naturally occurring. It isn't like going mine hydrogen somewhere. Hydrogen is bound up with a lot of other elements. You know, it's in water. It's everywhere. Right? How do you make hydrogen? General way of making hydrogen is using electricity to split water into the two components, oxygen and hydrogen. And wind farms are extremely well suited to this task. But that would mean that you don't site a wind farm where it has to be close enough to shore so it can send the electricity through the pipe. You know, electricity doesn't travel a long distance. It dissipates, it loses juice when it goes too far. Transmission line has to be used locally, which even lends us more towards fuel cells. It is not a commodity that you can take a piece of electricity generated in California and send it to New York. It will never make it. It will just dissipate into the air as it moves down through the resistance, the very resistance of the lines itself, of the copper itself, or aluminum, which they use more and more of those lines. Right? To the lighter. Alright, so you have this problem here where you have this whole infrastructure of this thing is built up to support an existing oil, coal infrastructure. And what should you be doing with power plants like this? You'd be putting them on barges and moving them around the ocean wherever it's opportunistic to pick up the wind. And then taking the electricity that's happening from there and split the water right on the spot and create hydrogen, put it in big tanks and liquefy it, and then send it back somewhere. That's the way to do it. But this particular project is sited so that it's exactly outside the jurisdiction of state control, and the minute that Romney attempted to pull some rocks part of Massachusetts, they cranked it back. And why do they want to stay in federal waters? Because there's no taxes that they will have to pay in federal waters. There's no oversight for them in federal waters. The Army Corps of Engineers is the Corps of last hope, the only regulatory board, and it's not even the proper regulatory board. So it's problematic. The whole thing is problematic. You got these guys that are only there for profit. Take away the tax credits and they're gone. They're only there for the tax credits. And it is more expensive to generate juice out of that, even by their own figures, Ray, it costs twice as much to generate juice out of the wind farm when they amortize everything than it does to generate oil and gas. And the only reason it's economically feasible is because it's going to come out of our tax dollars. And we're not going to get any lease money back from these guys. It's the exact same incentive that caused the atomic plants to be built in the 60s and 70s. The same incentive. You don't have to pay any money to us, and we'll subsidize you with tax dollars. And therefore, atomic energy becomes cheaper than oil and gas, when it never was. It was considered cleaner, but it's actually more polluting in the long run. Now we have these oil.
Well, yeah, in the long run, though, you don't have to buy the wind.
No, you don't.
You do have to buy the oil to burn it to make electricity.
Well, again, like everything else of this time, what is the main characteristic of this time? The main characteristic of this time is a misallocation of resources. You have this country who is for a small elite band of people trying to reallocate resources to ensure their dominance and power, and causing, we're going into what's called the South American model. And the South American model is you have a few rich people living on the hill and everybody else lives in tin shacks at the bottom of the hill. The disparity between rich and poor, between the elites and the haves and the have-nots, is greater and greater and greater. And in this way, it's much easier to exercise control and to manipulate these resources around. And if you can get the people poor enough, well, then you can allocate more resources to yourself in general. You'll guarantee your own flow of oil and everything else. So it becomes problematic. You know, it becomes a scene where we're participating in the last strike of the Antichrist all the way down the pipe. The whole reason you guys want to protect oil and all this other stuff, right, is because they're protecting an old infrastructure. This infrastructure isn't essential anymore. You know, it's like aging pipes. Come on, we're using combustion engines that are 150 years old. You know, the first combustion engines, steam engines, and all that, just the idea of pushing a piston around, it's old technology. And we're way beyond that. But these guys would lose a lot of money having to move into a new technology. You know? People would lose their whole thing. And energy is never going to be a problem. There is more energy everywhere than we could ever possibly use. I mean, there's this material called methylhydrazine, which is on the continental shelves of every continent, and basically what it is called frozen methane. And the pressure of the ocean and the temperatures pull the stuff out. It looks like ice, and you can light it up and burn. And there is enough of this stuff to fuel us at our present rate for 50,000 years, just on the Earth alone, you know, let alone other renewables such as solar and all that other did, which are getting much more effective. But for all of these schemes to work, you have to decentralize the grid, because the grid will only operate on fossil fuels. So support something like renewables, support something like hydroelectric power, you're supporting the grid. You're supporting the fossil fuel movement even more than you would otherwise. Scary stuff. So we look at this chart here. We have this, I think you got my point, that the United States is a renegade nation. We don't want to deal with anybody on the planet. And this business with liberals and right-wing and all that other jazz is just another fiction that could be as invented by Karl Rove as anybody else. These are not really the issues on the planet. Nobody's talking about the real issues on the planet, which have to do with allocation of resources, point blank. Other thing to note, the United States is no longer the controlling economic power on the planet. China is. And particularly if you take a consortium of China, India, and Brazil, they dwarf both the United States and Europe combined.
China what
in
Brazil?
India. India and Brazil. It dwarfs the GNP of the United States and Europe combined at this point in time. Now, what has caused the run-up of oil prices in the last 2 years? China's demand for oil. China could not last year, could only achieve 75% of their oil imports. That was it. They were 25% short. And they couldn't pay the people. We need the oil. We want to buy the oil now, because if they did, everybody would bid up the prices. Well, now they all know. They bid up the prices. Okay, you guys, you need the oil. We'll make you pay. Meanwhile, we still have long-term contracts, which is why it hasn't hit us here yet. Why was Germany and France so upset that we went to Iraq? Because they had long-term oil contracts with Iraq. They had gotten paid off by Saddam, and they had all their contracts, and they were fixed for oil. Britain had the North Shore oil. So they were fine about supporting the U.S. They know where their bed is feathered. But that's why Germany is mad at us. We took away their long-term oil contracts. Just took right out. We walked into their house, opened their refrigerator, and took their Thanksgiving turkey and left. You know, and said, okay, what, you're upset? Well, screw you. Better keep quiet or I'll punch you in the mouth. That's our attitude, you know. You better keep quiet. We'll just punch you in the mouth. We'll send a couple of jets over to Libya and bomb the hell out of you. You know, so So this is going on. It's the China, it's China's thing, but China's the country to watch. China's really the country to watch right now. Because, you know, China is kind of like where the United States was before the crash of 29. No controls on their capitalistic currency, on their capitalistic system. The Chinese currency is not convertible. You can't take Chinese, what are they called, yuan or whatever they are. Yeah. No, reals, yuanes.
Yuan.
You can't take them and go out and buy a dollar with them. But they're indexed to the dollar. So if the dollar falls and gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, China gets happier and happier.
That's correct.
Yeah. And if the dollar falls cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, large debtors like us, and remember they mentioned how Japan got wiped out because our dollar devaluated. And Japan's been in a depression ever since that happened. They never really recovered. You know? That this is one of our classic ways of getting rid of debt. We did this in the 20s. We got Great Britain to invest like crazy into the U.S. Like really, like mad into the U.S. And then we had a depression. And it wiped out all the British investments. And as the British guys went bankrupt, the U.S. banks took these assets over and redistributed them to the farmers in the Midwest. They invested in all the farms and everything else. You know, and we had the farm collapse in 1925 preceding the Great Depression. And was one of the, they call it one of the contributing factors to the Great Depression, but it was really the key factor to the Great Depression. We're in a very similar situation with China right now. The guys in China figured out the trick that the guys in the United States figured out during the crisis with the SNL loan scandal, where essentially you have this idea that you can go out to the bank and say, all right, I'm going to build a factory. I'm going to employ 10,000 people. And I'm building on this field over here, right? Look, I got the work permits, and I got guys going to sell me the field and all that sort of. Give me the money, and I'll build the factory. They said, hey, good idea. Here's all the money. The guy goes out, builds the foundation of the factory, and says, oh, I'm bankrupt now. I'll leave the country. This is happening in China like crazy, right? Not only that, you have a problem with imports and exports in China. China spends all their money modernizing their export facilities. But they didn't do a damn thing about their import facilities. Right? So, you can get something manufactured in China and have it shipped to the port of Los Angeles in 4 days. In 4 days, you can have your goods coming in on a super tanker right out of the Chinese port, right into the U.S., right? 6 days at most. But if you send a load of scrap steel to China and go into their receiving port, you're stuck outside that port for 3 months at $5,000 a day. Now, it used to cost $20,000 to ship a load of steel over to China, right? But their demand is so high that now it's costing close to $250,000 to ship that same load of steel, right? Meanwhile, the company on the other side, the Chinese company, I imported a load of steel, right, and I've got this warehouse space on the dock. They finally get the ship unloaded, get the stuff in the dock. All their competitors will say, sell me some of your steel, sell me some of your steel. And it's like, oh, okay, well, we really only need half of it. Let's wait a few days and see if they bid up the price. So they're displacing the warehouse space, doing run-ups on these commodities, and it backs up the port even more. And the railroads can't even get the stuff moved out fast enough. This is a problematic thing. This is how you lead to a collapse. This is a bubble. Everybody here is worried about the housing bubble and stuff like that. And I've been predicting that the housing bubble should have gone to shit when Saturn went to Cancer. Right? And I have these other people that are saying, oh no, it's Vedic astrology is really cool. That's when Saturn crossed the 0 degree Cancer in the sidereal system, in the Vedic system, right? Oh, we've had a peak of the housing market. No, the housing market, they don't know what a housing market collapse is. You know, a housing market collapse is a real big thing. It takes a real long time. And you know, we're such smart Yankee traders, you know how we're going to avoid the housing collapse? We're going to make cheaper dollars. We're going to make the dollars worth shit. So that, you know, it'll be bad for poor people, but the rich guys will be able to eliminate their debt. And we'll eliminate all the bondholders overseas. Except for one bad problem. I think it costs us $3.8 billion a day to fund the U.S. government right now. You know, if we have to sell $3.5 billion worth of treasury notes, you know, debt service, debt instruments every single day, right? That accounts for 80% of the net income of the world. That's not sustainable. Already they had a very strange day in September, September 9th to be precise. And around September 9th, the U.S. Treasury had an auction and nobody came. Nobody did. You can raise them on U.S. Treasury
security.
Yeah. And nobody came. And after that, it all went back to normal. They said, oh, well, this is an anomaly. But, you know, China's going to wise up. They've got a lot of money to spend. So does Japan. They're going to wise up. They're not going to invest in U.S. Treasury instruments if the dollar falls and they're going to lose money on their investment. So they'll pull back. This will be the real crisis. This will be the real crisis. So you're going to have a tumble in China followed by an inversion in the U.S. Now, this is supposing that the U.S. is operating at full tilt fully. But a few other things are going on here that not many people are taking advantage of or observing. One is natural disaster. In my original... prophecy for this period of time was that the United States went into mediocrity primarily because we were overextended in the world and we had a series of natural disasters that reduced our ability to be involved in the world arena. Now, four hurricanes hitting Florida is a good example of such an effect. North America's always been a very volatile continent, you know?
Yeah, and it's funny how Texas is like under 10 feet of water right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Waiting for what happened to Ohio.
They already got laid off in Ohio.
Right.
Well, the Cascade is very important, right?
Aren't you? They are.
If we take into consider Florida, that what's the net effect of the hurricanes in Florida?
Tomatoes, $4 a pound.
That's right. And what's going to happen to our winter wheat crop, our domestic winter wheat crop? Also, same thing, vegetables, all the winter
potatoes,
stuff.
All of that. Florida's a big potential that nobody thinks about.
That's right. All of our winter foods are going to get, just as much as gas shock, we're going to be getting a food shock very, very shortly. It's masked by the fact that we're importing food and stuff all over the place. But let's suppose now, like Mount St. Helens has shown increasing activity.
Rainier did too.
Rainier's pulled a few rumbles. But nobody observed the mountain that's down, 75 miles from Guadalupe. There's a volcano down there that also has been blowing.
Oh, is it
Montserrat?
Yeah. No.
Not Montserrat.
No.
It's one of those guys.
Oh, Central America.
Yeah. It's an Mexico.
It's right at the bottom of Mexico, because I lived in Central America back in the 70s, and that's like it's been off and on all the time.
That's right. Well, it hasn't had a real big blow for 510 years, and they said that it's really showing strong signs, and nobody's paying attention. Well, midway between those two mountains on the Pacific Rim is Parkland, California. Or Parkview, where they just had a 7-point earthquake about 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, that was out in the middle of nowhere. You know, a few groceries fell off the shelves, and that's about it. Let's take this a little bit further. We don't have to have California falling into the sea. Right? All we need is an earthquake that knocks out a few key infrastructure environments. A couple of bridges that take a long time to rebuild. Some railroads. We don't even need that stuff. A few railroad connections. That's all we need. We need a 10% slowdown in the movement of goods and services out of Port of Los Angeles. And boom, the United States is out of commission. Out of commission as far as the world market is concerned. So everything's going in and out of Port of Los Angeles.
Right.
You know, and they can't even keep up there. You know, that... You know, when we had that quake in Santa Monica and we had the quake in San Francisco, well, you know, everybody gets scared about these things. Oh, we're all going to drop dead in an earthquake or something like that. But bottom line is, that isn't what the problem is. The problem is the destruction of the infrastructure. And we do the thing in San Francisco and all like this. Well, the highway collapsed, you know, 880 collapsed. And then we did the thing in Santa Monica and we lost a couple of freeway bridges. But let's suppose that a couple of large bridges go out and a couple of railroad lines get disrupted. That really screws everything up. You don't need a lot of disruption to really cause large-scale problematic. So, if you own a house and you're paying a mortgage on $200,000 or $300,000, costing you $3,000 a month, right? Well, you'll be able to pay that back with cheaper dollars if you can continue making those cheaper dollars. What was the big deal in the Great Depression?
No jobs.
Right, 25% unemployment.
Right.
But if you had a job, any job, you were doing great.
Right.
You
right.
ate. You ate.
It was like my grandparents, because there were 10 kids and the adults, they never felt the depression.
Right.
Whereas my dad, so his family felt the depression in great quantity because they were money people and lost it.
Yep. Well, you gotta remember now, that's what the shakeout is all about.
Yeah.
And so you got these people that are billionaires and they're gonna shake out all the millionaires.
Yeah.
We can afford to lose 20%. You know, but the other people can't. And then it makes more resources for us. But this is not a conscious thing. It's not a conscious movement. There are other entities going on here. There are other entities involved.
Do you think it has to be like a quick period of disaster? Or?
No.
Because I think of like with global warming, we're just going to see more and more hurricanes and floods, and it's going to get a little bit worse every year.
But with the global warming, we keep talking about the hurricanes and that. The whole thing about global warming is the extremes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ice storms as well as the hurricanes that are going to kill us. People couldn't move around New England with all the ice and stuff, and that was just small.
Well, you have to understand things like with earth movement, natural disasters, and stuff like that. Humans don't have a problem with this.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. We really don't. That's why we're here. We're weed species. We can adapt to things. You know? I mean, why is it that we are the way we are? You know, the whole thing with evolution now has to do with the fact that we were built to run.
Right.
We were runners. That's why we have big butts and all that other stuff, because the apes have real small butts. They can't run a great distance. So we were able to run, and because of that, we had to balance with our heads, so our heads got bigger. It's a better balance point. Truly.
The newest stuff,
you know, is that this is the reason we've evolved such. So, global warming, sea level rise, people get displaced. You know, think about potato famine in Ireland. Boy, that was pretty bad stuff. What did they do? They left.
But that's the people. I'm talking about the structure. You can't move with ice, and you can't move with hurricanes.
The other thing about the structure, too, is as far as I'm concerned, you look out at that street, and there's like macadam on the road, and there's all these wires going by and stuff like that. That's old infrastructure. In the newer world, when all this particular period of crisis passes by 2012, 2013, it's rebuilding itself. By 2020, it will become apparent that if you have no infrastructure, you're better off than if you have an infrastructure. You have no infrastructure. So the infrastructure itself is going to be an impediment. It's like living in the Roman ruins in the 8th century. You know, what good did it do living in the shadow of the Colosseum? You know, it didn't do you any good at all.
He took the wood and went home and burned it.
Yeah, pretty much, you know. But we can't do that with the wires and stuff like that, you know, or the mechanical. So I look at the infrastructure itself. You know, it's not worth preserving. You know, there is a large element of change about to occur. Now, in the end, this change will be very good, but the political method of getting there stinks. So you have this guy who's come into power. It's accelerating in this particular chart. I'm sorry, I haven't done too much with it, but we will. It's accelerating with this particular chart. He's just a catalyst. He goes away. But the legacy is horrible. The after effect. The hangover is bad news. All right, so what are we specifically doing this year? Right. Here we have the United States, Meridian stands with Washington, 7th house, that Saturn is on the 7th house from the Meridian. If I put the pointer on the midheaven, right, that would be the 10th house, 11th house, 10th house, 9th house, 8th house, 7th house. Bam, nobody likes us. Whoa, poor us. Right? And that meridian is opposing the node and in half square to Mercury.
Yeah.
Some serious stuff is coming out of the U.S. Right? Some seriously weird stuff is coming out of the U.S. But, you look at Mars, and you see that Mars connects that midheaven to the cardinal axis, obviously connecting Saturn to the cardinal axis. Right? We look at this on the 90-degree wheel, right? It becomes even more so. Here's our cardinal axis. There's our Saturn axis. If we do it this way, it looks a little bit better. Now, we just look at the midpoint of Saturn and Sun, right? We see it a little bit better here. And we see that Mars at the midpoint. That means that only the U.S., that midheaven, connects Mars. See, if we take the midheaven out of here, boing, gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have Mars essentially standing at the midpoint between Saturn and the world. And it's easier seen on this 360 here, right? We see Sun, we see Saturn and the cardinal. Now that's a bad picture for the world to begin with. This means that people die, people are disrupted, very, very big frustrations are going on, everybody's mad, right? In general, how is it manifesting? Through the midheaven of Washington. Right, through the midheaven of Washington. So it's through that. So we see that how is the United States going to try and solve a lot of its problems? It's going to try and solve a lot of its problems through military means, through warlike means. Now that meridian, as I pointed out, Saturn runs with the Mercury. If we look at the same thing here, there's the meridian for Washington running in the half square to Mercury, Saturn Mercury time, right? Running with the ascendant by 22 and a half. So this is Washington. Either very thick and stupid or real focused on the bottom line. Now we turn on the TNTs. We turn on the TNTs, right? We see that Saturn is half squaring Mercury and Cupido. Now, what Mercury Cupido is the commerce of industry. Saturn is the way. Saturn Cupido is the separation of the family. We minus Mars from the axis, you see that it equals Hades. Pretty precise. So we will be embarking on mass genocide. The Fallujah invasion, which I called, Sam called me up before the election, and we were looking at that, and I said, well, it isn't the election, it's right after the election. When transiting Mars comes down and squares Saturn, that will be a real drag, which is pretty much in these degrees, because at that point in time we'll probably invade Fallujah and we'll probably be engaging in a lot of genocide that they're not going to report in this country. And they haven't. They haven't reported anything. But two things have occurred since the election. One is they're printing the names of the dead in your newspaper. They did not do that prior to the election. Because remember, we have a lame duck in office now. And two, they're showing pictures of the pastors, which was illegal to do prior to the election.
Oh, Washington, besides that, now that the election is over, all of a sudden things are being vocalized.
Correct. And what kind of vocalization is this for the course of this year? Not too cool. Now, normally, Mercury and Cupido is singing and dancing. Right? Mercury Cupido rules singing and dancing. It's the happy group. It's the group. It's the baiting society. It's to get together with talks. It's to get together to sing. It's a nice thing. But it stands with Mars and Hades, which means to murder. To kill. Right? So if we were to look at Mars, Hades, right, and subtract Mercury from the picture, right, and we look at our interpretation, criminal thought, thoughts of murder, suicide, to think of activities causing losses and damage, abuse of words, cursing vilely, to have to deal with dangerously stupid people.
Speech impediment. What's a speech impediment?
Nobody. My lips move. Right? And we go to Mars and Hades, and we minus the midheaven from the axis, right? Able to commit mean acts or murder, to want to avenge oneself, an eye for an eye, to suffer or to be separated mentally through mean acts of others, be fed up, to have one's fill, quickly annoyed and weary, ugly deeds which bounce back, actions surprising.
Is that minus midheaven?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Many under difficult circumstances.
You know, I stayed up all night so I could go shopping early on yesterday.
Friday, yeah.
And I was like passing out and I had this weirdest vision of that something Colin Powell says or does is going to cause the whole administration to come tumbling down.
Well, he's a wild card.
The same picture minus Saturn, right, gives us murder by death or suicide, death by crushing, activity with many losses, work without pay, smoking, right? Mars, Saturn, minus Cupido, they're all on the same axis. To lose a husband by murder, death at social events, meeting of lowbrow people, activity with others in socially low surroundings. It goes on and on and on. And this whole thing also equals the ascendant for Washington. So, what's the next big ding-dong going to occur? Well, it's going to occur in Washington, eye for an eye. Either it's going to come out of Washington or go from Washington. But it also means that this is the year to go underground. This is the year to duck and cover. Because this is the year that the vengeful leader is going to go after all of his perceived enemies. And it makes Richard Nixon's enemies look like play toys. You know? Not a very good thing. Now, if we move this picture around to the ascendant, right, we look at the bottom here and we have Neptune and Admetos. And if we connect Neptune and Admetos together, right, the general world comes into a new form of being. If we minus the ascendant from the axis, change intent in relation to the environment or to other people. Others experience a change in the environment. Others enter into a new form of being. What is that new form of being? Slow change of condition. The present condition starts slowly changing. A condition is sustained or preserved. Break up of the family or community. Change in living conditions for the worse. And finally, speeches, writings, opinions of thought about new forms of being. And of course, that whole picture stands with the Mars and Hades. And that whole picture also stands with Jupiter and the Moon. Which
now, have a lot of media reporting on all this.
Well, Jupiter and the Moon in general amplify things. It isn't necessarily a good combination. It amplifies things. Now, what's waiting in the wings here? During the course of this year, Pluto's going to hit Hades. And what is the meaning of Pluto and Hades? It's a downward development. It's a lousy change. General decline. Symptoms of deterioration or decadence. General depravity and breakdown.
How long from now?
Very shortly. As a matter of fact, if we take this thing now and we start a step rate here of, we'll go in 7-day increments. Right? Let's go ahead now. I'm going to go ahead in time. Right? One, boing, boing. There we go. That is on 1/11/2005.
Right before the inauguration.
Right before that. And if we go back one, you'll note that we get Mercury and Venus with all this other jazz right around January 4, which is when the Earth is closest to the Sun and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Right? Mars comes crossing over the cardinal by 22.5. So this is the combination. This is the combination of the year to watch, is that Hades and Pluto. That's one of them. The other thing to note as well is that Vulcanus and Apollon are breaking up, so that the great prosperity of the world now is becoming a memory. Saturn will be getting hit by the node soon as well. So go again, step ahead, look at that node, watch the node moving backwards. And that will be by May. And that will not be a lot of fun either, because it runs with Vulcanus. So if you look, Saturn plus Vulcanus here is the people in general subject to strong hindrances and obstacles, and therefore have to watch for their opportunities or advantages, minus the node, to experience strong hindrances through one's connection, to be connected with people who are themselves are attentive, vigilant, and on guard. Guard spelled wrong. Oh, no.
No, it isn't.
You're right. No, it's correct. Looks weird in that typeface.
Yeah.
But you get the sense of what's going on here. This is all running with the cardinals by 22.5. All runs with the cardinals. Alright, so those two things are going on. The main thing, however, is this one. Look at this Cronus and look at this Neptune. And as we move forward in time, weekly here, look at the Neptune, look at Cronus. Look at the Neptune, look at Cronus. Watch the watch, watch the watch, watch the watch. Right. Here's Neptune standing on the cardinal. For the, not the last time either. We go back, 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 we go back. And then Neptune starts moving forward. What is that Neptune and Cronus doing this entire time? There's a little half square going on here. It's just a quadrate between the two. We keep going forward in time. Neptune gets up to its point and starts moving forward again. Or backwards, rather. And again, we have that half square occurring. Here we are in July. Neptune crosses the cardinals again. And then comes forward. It stations at 1448, I think. Yeah, I think it's 1448. Let me see. There it is. 1449. Stations at 1449. Right, and then it comes forward. And oops, I'm sorry, going the wrong way. Just go, 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 go. There we go. Now it comes forward, and it makes that last hit with Cronus here while Jupiter is running. And we're in January 24, 2006. So basically, throughout this year, Neptune and Cronus are running in half squares over the cardinal axis. And it's been running this way since Bush's election, originally. And inability in the ruling circles. The general public lives under the wrong impression. It's kept there, so the wrong impression is increased. Okay. Now, minus Aries, inability in ruling circles. The general public was in the wrong, kept their wrong. Oh, she did this twice. Minus the sun, rather. Let's do minus the sun. Get over there, you. That needs to be fixed. The failed manager, the man who was under the wrong impression, who was deceived, who played the game of deception. Days on which the native is involved in deception or deceiving. So, you know, we've got this condition going on in the world. And this is the incompetency that's been there in the first place. In other words, it's like a bureaucratic managerial motion here. And it's like not too cool, you know. They're making bad policies, bad ideas, bad stuff going on. And we know all this. Come on, we're Northeasterners. We're not living in Arizona. We're not, you know, in Iowa somewhere, you know, that kind of thing. Nothing wrong with the people in North and South Carolina and stuff like that. I mean, except for the fact that they're not taking the time to investigate properly. They always guys talk about the liberal media, then there's other guys talking about the agenda of the right wing media and all sort of this. I look at all media like I would be reading Pravda under Stalin. You know, to me it's one big pack of lies. You have to look between the lines. Both sides. You gotta look between the lines, you know, discern what the hell is really going on. So what does it do for us? It means you better be quiet. In that prophecy that I made in the 70s was basically that when the no good SOB comes to power, you have to be quiet and submit. Right? The United States will go to mediocrity. But then again, when the Roman Empire fell, the individual people living on their estates did well for many generations, for hundreds of years. It was a very interesting thing. When the first one of the Visigoths, the guys came through, was the Huns. I don't know, one of those guys came through and invaded southern France, right? And all the Roman guys that had all these, their, you know, farms out there and stuff like that were like freaking out, oh my God, the Huns are coming, they're going to kill us all, you know, that kind of thing. But the Huns were sending emissaries out and negotiating with the landowners for their land. And there's one Roman, I remember reading a letter from one of the Roman guys saying, Well, you know, they were real fair. They gave me a good price for my land, safe passage, and I went to Spain. And I bought more land. It was like these guys were real civilized. It was pretty cool. But yet, historically, we see it very differently. Well, we're in a first world country. And I keep telling people, we're in a first world country. Even right here, we're in the Switzerland of the United States. And this is the Switzerland of the United States. This is where the money class actually resides. I mean, come on. For all Bush's business about having a house in Crawford, Texas, and all that other stuff, his family's still up there in Kennebunkport, Maine, and he was educated in Connecticut. You know, I mean, he's just as much of a Northeasterner as John Kerry was, you know. But by the way, about John Kerry, the interesting thing there, side note, is Karen Thorne, the astrologer in Lincoln, she was vice president of the NCGR up there for a long time. Well, her name is Thorne. And she was married to David Thorne, who was roommate with John Kerry, and John Kerry married his sister, Julia Thorne. And back in 66, they had gotten a divorce a few years earlier, both of them, and Karen was telling me, oh yes, John Kerry, he's going to be the next president. He's going to run for president. I mean, that's what this whole guy's ambition is, all that. He's going to run for president. You watch. I've had too many barbecues with him. You know, he's going to be up. And you know, during the entire Clinton time, she was constantly getting invited to the White House. You know, she's always down there having dinner with you know, we keep hearing about it going to the White House all the time. That, you know, it's just how small, you know, 6 degrees of separation with everything. It's really true. Well,
less than that around here.
Less than that around here, successfully. You know? But 6 degrees of separation. So, you know, already back then, the ambitions were well laid out. But it was just another guy representing the same machinery. And he said, the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans are extremely narrow. And in truth, it's all masking something else altogether. You know? I mean, I saw the Bill Maher show where Mike O'Moore and Bill Maher got on their knees and were begging Ralph Nader not to run. How could you do this, Ralph? You shouldn't run. He got real embarrassed, you know. But in truth, Nader's the only honest guy in the bunch in terms of him saying it makes no difference. There's no difference between those two parties. I can't call myself a Democrat anymore. And Howard Dean, you know, he shut that guy right down. I mean, what was his problem? He had no problem. He basically wanted to redo the party reformer. He was a populist reformer. Boom, shoot him right down. You know, they got the blandest guy. I went to a lecture by the woman who was Al Gore's head of his campaign. Was Diane or Donna something? Something with a G.
Brazil?
Brazil. Yeah, that's, yeah. She spoke here in Brewster. And at the time, there was like 9 people running, and she basically said, it's going to be John Kerry who's going to run for the Democratic Party. And she says, the fix is already in. The other guy can't run. He's going to raise more money. He's already done all the backroom work. And she says, and besides, the good thing, he should be running. All these other guys aren't electable. The theory that pervades there. So we're in a very strange place. And the advice basically is threefold. One, money. Money's been devalued during the course of this year. So what do? How do you protect assets? Right, what can you possibly do? You can't invest in paper like in the market. You can't invest in bonds. Don't run to gold. Gold will trade upwards. But you have to consider, gold is not the same as it was in 1981. You know, when inflation was going crazy and everybody bought gold and they bid it up to $800 an ounce before it crashed, even in 1981, gold was still a standard for a lot of other currencies. Now it's not at all. And it's just an industrial metal. And the biggest market for gold is jewelry. And if we have a depression, there is no jewelry market. And the industrial usage for gold has been dropping like a stone because they were trying to find all kinds of substitutes for an expensive precious metal. Whether you invest in precious metals, and plus every person on the planet is going to flock to gold and bid the price up. So for a while there, it'll shoot through the roof until nobody, you know, can buy it anymore, and it'll just collapse like a stone. because it really has no intrinsic value, especially if people start having to get their gold future shipments to their door. You know, truck drives up, you own 2 tons of gold, you know. So what can you do? Excuse me. Well, in terms of that kind of area, the thing to invest in would be in things like platinum, which has a heavy industrial use and is scarce. You know, you spend so much time looking for gold, not enough time looking for platinum, chromium, any of the rare earth metals and earth elements.
What about the earth itself? What about land? What about real estate?
Land is way more valued in the United States. The only thing that's going to happen is going to... Is there's not going to be a market. See, markets only work as long as there's demand. And nobody's going to buy land at these costs. Now, I know this because I've been in the land acquisition committee for the town. I've had $15 million to spend now for the last 6 years buying land around here in Brewster, and I just watch it, and it's just like incredible. You know, land is bubbled up by the demand. So on the Cape, land will not, the housing will not devalue more than 20-30%. But if you go out to Pittsfield or Western Mass or something like that, it's going to fall through the floor because there's no demand. There's no intrinsic demand for the land. There isn't finite there. Okay? The most important thing about land right now is housing itself. Make sure you have a roof over your head. If you're paying a mortgage, you better be a mortgage for your own house, not in a speculative sense. So using land as a speculation or as a holding device for funds, it will just erode your funds. The other thing you can invest in would be other currencies. You can't invest in bonds in other nations because they'll be subject to whatever the payback schedule is that's dominated by the dollar. But you can't, for example, if you bought euros at 80 cents on the dollar, you would be a rich man right now. Because it's trading at $1.30. You see?
Yeah.
Even the Canadian dollar, which is trading at 60 cents on the US dollar, is now trading 85 cents on the US dollar. You know, and that's pretty scary. So other currencies, and it means moving money, means being an educated person and having to move your money around all the time. All the time. And not with the idea of a speculative venture where you're going to gain funds because of some investment. Oh, I'm going to have this long-term investment from gaining. No, just to keep your funds from eroding. So that's going to be the big pressure. The deflationary spiral that started in 92 is finally going to be a bane in our existence, you know? You have to think, if China stops nominating their currency on the index to the dollar, well, that $17 DVD player that was on sale at Best Buy yesterday is going to cost $300 overnight. So, you know, goods and services and whatnot are phenomenally cheap to us, but the only reason they're phenomenally cheap is because the dollar is phenomenally overvalued. That DVD player we're paying $17 for is still $300 in a third world country. You know, still unattainable good. And these guys are all fighting it out now here in the United States because we're the last viable market. Europe is in a malaise, but Europe in the long run actually has a better shot. I consider Europe as having one of the best shots to surviving this time. Because even though they're not going to grow economically, at least they're going to remain stable. Not a hell of a lot is going to happen in Europe. The rest of the world, a hell of a lot is going to happen. Right? A given. Right? Next, what do you do here in terms of personal survival? Join the Republican Party.
Because
seriously,
I want to go behind the curtain.
Join the Republican Party. The way the prophecy went, the way my personal prophecy went, was that this guy dies in office.
Yeah,
that's
the way he's right.
Well, it's just the whole thing.
There's all that murder going on.
Well, he dies in office and he leaves no heirs. This is the thing, that once he dissolves, the coalitions that put him together really won't know what to do. It's like the rest of this Groff article, which Ray didn't give the rest of it, so he kind of cuts off here, but...
Oh, I thought it was all there.
No. But in the rest of the Groff article, he goes on to say that when he actually debates this right-wing neocon, the guy gets up and says, it's like, this is after the election. And he's doing the campaign rap. Oh, yeah, well, you know, we had to invade Iraq because Saddam was a bad guy. And, oh, yeah, Kerry would have been a lousy guy if we invaded Iraq. And he says it like four times. And once this guy Groff starts hitting with these other arguments, the guy shuts up. he has nothing to say. And he says he even got beat red when he brings up Haiti as a failed U.S. intervention. You know, it's like, well, if the United States isn't into nation building, then what the hell are we doing in Haiti? Why are we in Haiti in the first place? Why did we throw out the Aristide government? The United States engineered that, too. Yeah, and then we make it the worst place in the world, and then two hurricanes hit the place. And those people are screwed. I mean, they're screwed. And you go 200 miles away to Grand Cayman, right, and same hurricane hit them. They got totally destroyed their infrastructure. They're doing just fine. You go across the border into the Dominican Republic. Right? They're doing just fine. Haiti's 5,000 people dying of flood. I mean, it's just terrible because, you know, we're bleeding this country dry, essentially. We don't want any nonsense down there. You know? Cuba will go through massive changes this year. One of the things about this Kronos and this Saturn is the dissolution of great world leaders, too. There is no leadership on the planet. That this guy Bush and all out there, that like when you're the king character, you destroy anything that can challenge you. You know, and there really isn't any challenges to him on the planet. So Arafat dying, Castro will go away. We've had a big change of leadership in China, which is taking effect now. Putin is consolidating his leadership. You can see the Saturn Uranus operating with the fight between Yashchenko and the other Y guy.
Oh, yeah.
The Y guy is over there. Right? A bunch of Y guys. Yeah, we're a bunch of Budinskis. Right? But you have all this going on in the world and no real positive leadership, and it's not going to be any. That's the other part of this year. You know, normally you have the checks and balances. Normally you have guys like Rockefeller, no good SOB, in the back room, you know, trying to control stuff. You know, J.P. Morgan in the 1929 crash, sitting around buying up banks really rapidly, you know, to prevent destabilization. Well, the old world view is that the world had to be a stable place. The new world view is not.
I mean, we've got a tiny little example here right now in Boston with the food center and the bank of America. Who wants it? No, nobody wants it. Put money on it? No, thank you.
Yeah. You know, it's very, there's not going to be a movement towards stability. Usually you get the, you know, once we upset the House of Cards, once we began invading sovereign countries without provocation, in the case in Iraq. Now, even Afghanistan, you know, Clinton did a couple of things correct. One was, you know, Osama blows up the coal. What does he do? He sends a whole bunch of cruise missiles in and destroys the camp, tries to target Osama himself. Right? Not that Osama is the, you know, Osama's only a representation of a larger movement, you know? Which, by the way, what country, who was Iran for during the last election in the U.S.? Who were they writing editorials in favor of? Iran. Yeah, they were pro-Bush. You know why they were pro-Bush? He said he left us alone.
Yeah.
He said they invaded Afghanistan. Well, that was a drag, but he invaded Iraq. Those were our enemies. They killed 8 million of our people, right? So, hey, he's a good guy, you know? So, like, the minute we, you know, it was a smart move was to send in bombs, to send in specific guys. But even Afghanistan could have been justified because we really didn't invade Afghanistan. All we did was throw a little weight to the opposition and allow them to have a successful civil war. We never put more than 11,000 troops in Afghanistan, you know, through all that stuff that was going on. And we put them in on horseback, right. Nonetheless. We sent in people on horseback because we didn't trust the Afghani helicopters.
That's
all special advice. They were CIA. We sent the CIA by horseback. They won the country. It was great. Right? But the bottom line is that was a mistake on our part because we invaded a sovereign nation. Even though we didn't like the Taliban, even though they were doing things the rest of the world thought sucked, and throwing up Buddhist statues and stuff like that, and being real bad to women, it still was an invasion of a sovereign country. And even Reagan had that sense of restraint. He went and bombed Libya, but he didn't invade Libya. You know, he bombed them. He shut them down. And they shut down. They stopped doing what they were doing, you know. But then we go into Iraq, and this is an invasion of sovereign country, and this is worse than Sarajevo setting off World War One. This is the dominoes coming down. And there's nothing stopping us from invading another sovereign country like France.
Okay, and doing America.
We should go next. Let's take out the Eiffel Tower. Come on. Like, why are we screwing around, you know? I like those paintings in the Louvre. I'd like to see them in the National Gallery, you know? But it's really true. There is nothing, we are a morally renegade nation at this point in time, you know?
France is too hard to hold on to. Whenever you go for France in the risk game, you're like...
That's right. It's a tough one.
You haven't gone for any of them high risk, or you've been in Iran, you've been in Korea. You've picked on little countries that have some use, but grab
as Mr. Dacia puts it, you know, five superpower groups, naval groups supporting the transport of oil. We don't care where it's being shipped to. We just want to make sure it doesn't get disrupted. Well, yes, it's true. We go into that, and of course, where's the next big fight over there going to be? Saudi Arabia. There'll be a revolt by the Wahhabis, and it'll upset a lot of stuff there. I'm very, very surprised. Well, you see, Pakistan and India, I have been saying for a number of years, would start dropping nukes on one another because they felt that the world tensions there were very strong. And that could still happen. But the guy Musharraf, you know, he's like, he would be assassinated tomorrow. If he walked out on the streets of Karachi, he would be assassinated tomorrow. I mean, people hate him. His own people hate him terribly. But, you know, he's signed deals with us real fast. And part of the deal was you better patch it up with India. Because that was mostly, the Kashmir revolt was mostly supported by Pakistan. So Pakistan has to toe the line because they saw firsthand what we're doing. You know, and they said, okay, you're right. We'll join with you guys. We'll go with the winners. So the U.S. is going to prevail. Militarily, the U.S. is going to prevail. We're even going to win the insurgency that's happening in Iraq, even though it's going to descend into civil war and stuff like that. We'll win. We're going to win all these fights and battles. You know, it really is true that the Palestinians, the most they could fight back to the Israelis was with rocks. You know, I mean, suicide bomb is notwithstanding, it's a new tactic. You know, relatively speaking, it's only 4 years old. But they basically, all they had to fight with in the 80s and 90s was rocks. Therefore, we've read about them in the news and everything else like that, but they were a suppressed people with no hope, period. Well, the rest of the world has got the same condition with us. Compared to our military, all they can fight back with is rocks. That's it. So, militarily, we will prevail. But it doesn't mean that it's going to be a good victory. It's going to be a hollow victory. Because the whole conditions, the apple cart will have been upset so much that all the conditions will have changed. You know, through the conditions with which we're going to be fighting with. So, for this year, in general, we got this Mercury running with Cupido and all that other jazz, and Saturn and all jazz, sing and dance, get out and party. Have a good time now. You're in a first world country. It's the last place where they're going to be partying.
Mm-hmm. I saw the partying, that's why I was like, oh come on, Gary's going to see something else besides this big party that's going on.
Yeah. Have a good time, you know, Mercury, Cupido, Uranus, hey, it's like spontaneous, who's bringing the beer? You know, it's a nice thing. Look, it stands right near the cardinals and stuff. Because it will be one of the last times. The ascendant for Washington, look at that Kronos. That Kronos pulled that ascendant right into the cardinal axis. With Apollon. This is the ruler who seeks glory. But of course, he is surrounded by days of idleness and vice. See, Zeus and Hades, right? Is lack of coal. Oh, he's got it wrong. This is wrong again. It's days of idleness and vice, you know, is that Zeus and Hades. And so the idea here is that you have a rulership here who's going to revel in their glory and get real complacent about stuff.
He's already said, I'm going to spend your money. He meant it metaphorically, but I think he was like, woo!
Could you look at the local chart, too?
Some of Boston?
Because there was, like, all kinds of stuff going on with the Senate and the Midheaven. I didn't know what it meant, but it looked like it could be scary.
Yeah, he's a Taurus at the 4th instead of Aries.
Okay, so basically, in this wheel here, right? Yes, we changed sign.
Right, that's the one I was looking at.
Yeah, the local one here, right? The sun pops up into the 12th house. Well, essentially, the U.S. is going to ignore the Northeast as best they can.
They're going to punish us, isn't
it? Yeah, they're going to ignore us, pretty much.
The weather's going to punish us, too.
Mm. What, is the moon on the bottom?
Oh, yeah, it's going to be pretty wet.
Very wet and very stormy.
Okay,
it's
not going to be as cold as last year.
You can read it in the sheet. Yeah, it's been a cold weather around.
Well, it's winter, yeah. But it's not going like last year.
See, now, if we look at the meridian, for the Boston area, right, we see that it stands at the midpoint of Sun and Uranus,
yeah,
equals the meridian here, and Mars and the ascendant, which indicates some sort of major accident of some sort will characterize the area.
Really? Not the big dig with a 1,000 leaps?
No. No, not the death by a 1,000 cuts.
I mean, this is going to be the thing, you know, like they built the pyramid and then it's about why they did it. We're going to have the hole that nobody remembers why we did it, because no cars are going to be in there.
Actually, though, one of the things I have noted about Boston since the Big Dig project opened up is that the town is becoming a single entity again.
Oh, it is.
You know what I mean? The connection between the North End and the rest of the town is actually growing. You see the tentacles literally just beginning to lash out all over the place. And it does work. It does work in terms of channeling traffic around. Now you have Fifth Borough Drive and Memorial Drive and stuff like that.
I thought must have been looking at the wrong chart or something. I thought there's more stuff on the cardinal axis. Maybe it's the TMTs.
Well, if we throw the TMTs, other stuff does begin to occur. You know, here we get Hades running with Cupido, which indicates the fact they're going to cut us out of every piece of government funding you could ever think of.
That's what I said, we're going to be punished.
We're going to be really big punished here. Very big anger in this area and time. But see, Mars with ascendant with Sun and Uranus is an accident of some sort. Some disaster of an industrial nature occurs in this area that we're going to be obviously hearing around. And you get that meridian that runs with the Zeus. But this is pretty much, you know, the Boston corridor itself, so, but I'm not that concerned with it. I don't consider it that negative. It also means in some ways we're going to be the innovator of the area. You know, you got to remember, most of the munitions that are being used over in Iraq are manufactured around here in Connecticut, in central Massachusetts and stuff like that. This is, you know, it's true. What is it? South Park is Littleton, Colorado, you know, and that's where they make the missiles, the aerospace industry. But we make everything else. You know, or import it. You know, we're controlling it. That's the one thing. The ascendant axis connects the meridian and Mercury, so news will be coming at us here. We will be looked upon from a news fashion. That will be important for the area. This is Saturn and Cupido and Mercury running with ascendant and the sun for the Boston area. This is the changes that are going on. Remember that business with Neptune and Abydos to change, transform. So we're still connected with this Washington Midheaven in this corridor.
Is Romney walking out?
No, Romney's going to be in the news.
Yeah.
We do gain, the Boston area does gain, sun runs with meridian on the Jupiter, but we get Saturn ascendant. So I think this is why the housing market here will not be as damaging as it will be elsewhere in the country. You know? I think that we'll get by with cheap dollars, but those people that bought houses in Atlanta, they're really going to be in trouble. And if we take ascendant moon, which is the populace, the local people, see, they're having a good time. Venus, you know, no, really. They're having a good time with Jupiter and Volcanus.
We won.
We won the series. That's right. We won the series. The
curse, that's all anybody can think of.
The curse is over. That's all they're concerned about with Boston. But we do have, on a subtle level, Meridian Moon stands with Uranus and Cronos, which is the southern intervention of the authorities. Now, this may have to do with the wind farm and Big Dig function.
Right.
Because you do have Romney trying to throw out the head of the Turnpike Authority for no good reason. I mean, the guy wasn't even there when he built the damn thing. You know, who knows whether he's a good administrator or not, the Turnpike head. He just got a bug up his behind about it. And you have the Meridian Moon here, which is the public works. This is public works. The Meridian Moon is public works. And it stands with noted Poseidon. All the truth comes out. Not too bad around here. Not that bad around here. The rest of the world is pretty grim. We go back to Washington and just start doing the same kind of pictures. You know, Meridian Moon for Washington, right? Well, we see the node is running down. There's Cronos and Mars, right? So what's Washington going to do? They're going to beef up their security apparatus. Boy, Mars and Cronos is the guy with a uniform on, you know? And it stands with the node and stands with Moon and Meridian. We take, and we know that Ascendant Sun stands with that Cronos. We take, Moon Ascendant for the place of the people. Boy, we're really, you know, Washington gets weirder and weirder. The rest of the world thinks we're cantankerous, you know, and they're clear about it. Poseidon for the sun on all of that stuff. So, what was it, when Sherry called me up and said she was coming to the talk, you know, and said, now, Gary, you're not going to talk about stuff that's going to make me depressed, are you? I said, well, Sherry, I can't do much about the world going to hell in a handbasket. you know, it's really true. Good things are the fact that we will be the victors. The disastrous stuff that's going to happen to the U.S. happens over the next 2 to 3 years. The decisions being made in this country are, if you thought that they were bad before and incompetent, that just gets worse. It's really bad. They're really incompetent. That stuff's really nasty. The rest of the world is really grim. But we will be suffering in a split between rich and poor. That will accelerate. We are facing an economic Armageddon that comes shortly after the new year. So lock in your interest rates now. And we're going to go through
the roof. Isn't that interesting that somewhere in the subconscious that they're even doing these car sales about locking your interest now, and then all your future cars will be at this interest rate? But it's a weird indication that somebody has a feeling out there to market it.
Well, think about it this way. Think about it this way. Who is backing up all the cheap interest rates? Now remember, these are loans and bonds and stuff like that that you just don't, you know, they aren't short-term investments. You tie up, you back a mortgage instrument or something of that nature, you're in it for 20 years. You're in it for 10 years. Well, no, in terms of buying the bond.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in terms of the bond, you're in it for a while. So basically, it's all the people that went into this bond market in the last 5 years are the ones that are going to get royally screwed. They've already put their money up. That money's already at risk when this stuff collapses. Because they're already, all those loans, they're going to be, you know, interest rates will be running at 15 points, and they're going to be collecting at the rate of 2 or 3 points their
right,
share.
Yeah, right. Like CDs went way down.
Yeah, well, they're going to go up. They're going to go way up, you know. But the point is the money going to be worth anything in the first place? So we do have an economic Armageddon happening, and it's going to occur where the United States is going to be very, very poor because nobody's going to buy our treasuries. And that'll happen soon. It'll happen sooner than we think. That's in the early part of the year.
I listened to a German commentator on, because I like to listen to some of the American, you know, English versions of some of their news and that, and he was talking exactly about this in Germany. It was about the fact that if it was anywhere else,
We would have already gone. Artificially being held together. Now, the other thing to note is the Jupiter-Saturn square occurs later this summer. All right? If we go ahead in time here again, we go by our increments here. Right? Watch that Jupiter. He comes back. Right? Comes forward and he makes his run. He makes his run through Libra. See the Jupiter now? Mm-hmm. Almost weekly, he's moving multi-degrees. Mm-hmm. So finally, bam. Here we go.
Yeah. And we'll buy it right there. By the next solstice.
And that's by the next solstice we start happening to Jupiter and Saturn. And look at where it is. Look at that axis.
Oh.
Not a good thing. That's Pluto Hades, and that's the first thing that comes in this January. So it comes in, the crash, so to speak, or the run-up occurs in January and February, but the effects take almost 9 months to peter out to where we are. 9 to 10 months to get to us. So it doesn't, that part, again, isn't a lot of fun. So be wary of that one. Of course, the next week, Mars goes through the whole picture. Makes it more fun.
So,
next year's going to be really depressing.
That's right. Oh,
thank you for saying that.
Interesting isn't always fun.
Interesting isn't always fun. All right, questions about all of this stuff.
You know, it's a curse to say that you live in interesting times.
Hey, listen, at least we're in the latter part of our lives doing this thing.
Yes.
We are established. If you were 21 years old and trying to make a family at this point in time and facing these conditions, and your skill level was like basically that of a carpenter or something of that nature, even a holy carpenter, it's not a great office.
I mean, it's a good example of mine. How many times, I have a 30-year-old daughter. She's living with me because she can't survive. Not because she wants to. And there's a lot of that happening out there. I'm seeing it with a lot of people.
You okay?
I have a question.
Yes.
Pandemic.
Yes.
I was looking through my material, George McCormick. He's a great weather forecaster. He also did diseases and covered things like that. And in his research, he said you need something like a Neptune Uranus or a Pluto Uranus kind of thing going on to have a pandemic. And I was looking ahead this winter, and I really didn't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you can tell just from the ingress. How bad it
would
be.
When we, this year is not going to be too bad. It's not going to be, again, until we get to, not the first pass of Neptune over the cardinals. Here. September and October of next year.
Ah.
Here's where it begins to really occur.
What's that,
Poseidon Admeto? Poseidon
Admeto. What does that mean?
That actually rules atomic energy. the general educational facilities. Ideas meet with rejection in the general world. Well, also rules the origin of atoms, the origin of light. Poseidon Admeto is the basis of culture, the beginning of culture. And here we have Neptune.
Like the
Neptune, and here we have Neptune where it's like kind of splattering away. And I happen to pick this day where the sun is reflecting Hades on that axis with Uranus at 22 and a half. So that's a nice day to pick these things out because Poseidon Mars is there, so people are going to have to be making moral choices. And this would be when the flu vaccines would come out. But it is true, the avian flu and all that other stuff again would start hitting next year. I don't think that the Pluto Hades is going to be an epidemical kind of destruction. I think that that's going to be an economic one, and that will set the stage later for other nasty to happen, because once you destroy the infrastructure, there are no institutions. Institutions are very frail things. People think that because something has been around for 25 years, 30 years, 50 years, that some magical hand is guiding it. But as we all know, having been worked with volunteer organizations one way or another at different times, that all of these things owe their existence to a very tenuous thread.
Oh, I'm bored. Walk away.
It's a very tenuous thread, and institutions can get overwhelmed very, very rapidly, very, very easily. So, pandemic, I don't think so this year, later in this year. We start seeing it next fall. And the groundwork, however, is laid now with all those Neptune passes at 15. Understand that if Neptune passes 15 degrees of Aquarius, that the six signs are the manifestation of material in the world. You know, if Neptune were going over zero Aries or zero Cancer, well, that would be like a view of the world. You know, the world's getting the idea of Neptune. Things are dissolving in the world. Like, for example, Kronos goes up in Cardinals. We have a view of a great leader, right? Who has Neptune half square, so he's a lousy leader. But the Neptune, when a factor is going over 15 degrees of the sixth, it actually manifests in a material form. And Aquarius is the 5-11 house cusp of your horoscope. So it has to do with the movement of peoples and goods. This is where the Aquarius, that's why I say it's the trade relations with these various countries are going to be the trigger factor for a lot of the collapse. And the bubble will start in China. Because the trigger factor is going to be right there. It's already set up. And it's going to happen with their banks collapsing because of fraud. And the fact that their economy can't move because they can't get enough raw materials in. And you just think about it for one second. If China stopped importing for 1 week and just exported, the world would be in such deep doo-doo real fast. So when Neptune goes over 15 of Aquarius and is moving their business and all its other jazz being the central focus, it also tells us where the conduit is for the next series of illnesses and what's going on here. And that these things are an important thing. It also tells us the poisoning of the earth, the ecocide situation is very, very clear. Now the earth doesn't give a hoot about poisoning. It really doesn't. It's right there. It'll just make something else. We do. It's our own ecological needs that we're hurting. But then again, we're a weed species. You know? Look at kids living in a ghetto. You know, I mean, they're living in a toxic wasteland, but they survive. Not very well, but they survive. You know, we're a weed species. We live where everything else dies because of our nature. You know? So, the ecological suicide of the world, the ecological genocide of the world, also becomes manifest much more next fall. But all the seeds, Neptune always projects the future and lets you know. The con man tells you he's going to con you and he's taking your money. That's part of the confidence game. He says, oh, you can't, you know. You know, he says, yeah, you're right, I wouldn't do that either. You know, that kind of thing. That Neptune telegraphs in his own way. He telegraphs information in his own way. And so we see all these seeds going on. The thing with Neptune is we ignore them. We ignore them. We don't want to face up to the reality. So, how do you get through? How do you survive? How do you do all this other stuff? Well, the bottom line is this. If you're a late cardinal person, if you know, a lot of factors in late cardinals, then this early part of this year is really tough. If you have material in early six, the latter part of the year is going to be pretty tough. If you have a lot of material in the middle of the mutables, you're getting ready for a roller coaster ride.
What about your mutables?
Well, that's the Uranus. And if you're in a late mutable during the course of this year, conditions are turning downward. They're not, you know, they're improving if you're up to 23 degrees of mutables. If you're after that, there's a possibility a lot of things turn downward. If you're early cardinals, the early part of this year is very good. The early part of this year is very good. Any other questions?
I have another one.
Hey.
Hey, I'm Gemini.
Hey.
Happy full moon.
Yeah, happy full moon.
Space travel, this company that is $110 million and they're going to have public transport in the years to come. which I think is horribly exciting, terribly exciting, I should say. So, if I had the money, I'd go. What does it look like? Is there a picture for that?
Well, you look at Mercury, right? And we get the half-square Saturn, you know?
Okay.
And we had that whole thing, that whole space shot occurred in the last couple of months, right, where we had Saturn and Uranus standing on the cardinals, which is innovation. But one shot, innovation.
Yeah.
So they're not getting off the ground. They're not getting off the ground.
Wouldn't Jupiter be, you know, breaking, going beyond the boundaries?
Well, it helps, but we don't really get off the ground, per se, in the early part of this year. When transiting Jupiter gets down to that area where Saturn is now, it might make it a little bit better. I believe that space travel has to do with Neptune, Pluto, no, Neptune, Zeus, the rocket motor. Right, and see that Neptune and Zeus picture is standing near this Mercury Cupido. Now Neptune was further back, and so was Zeus when Bert Rutan's rockets went off and would have been hitting the Mercury of this chart. But my sense about it is that it all gets eclipsed by other stuff, and it all gets delayed. And they really don't get going until after this period, anyway. Anything else? Let's eat the food out in the kitchen. It all goes south.
You kept going on about all these cardinals and renewables, but what about that middle six?
Oh, Space Shot City. Space Shot City. So it's Middle Tarion, Middle Six, Middle Space Shot City.
We'll be going to space, pal.
Well, you
think about it. We'll be out.